Welcome to the crowd to the 5 o'clock budget work session. And I'm going to just let you take over.
To the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
I see they're both buried in the curtains on the wood.
What's that? All right.
Yep, I'll run with it. Just want to give the board just an update from last time. I sent out an email earlier just to kind of give the board a heads up on everything. So again, if you remember last budget work session on the 13th, up here is kind of the adjusting budget balance. We ended up with a $362,000 surplus. Today we are showing a $2,100 deficit. And basically the reason for that, nothing changed in any of the numbers below with exception of one small one. But we got updated numbers from the Commissioner of Revenue for personal property. And so you can see the personal property number decreased by $369,000 due to decrease in values, taxable values. And we had a very slight increase. I think it was about $5,000 in real estate, some additional real estate. And then one only really small change was under the schools. There was a number transposed in the request. Previously, we had $340,682. The request was actually $340,862, so it was a $180 difference, just to be completely transparent. So where we stand right now is the $2,100 deficit with everything else that the board included at the last work session. Depending on where the board wants to go from here, I'm happy to answer questions. I'm happy to show you things. If the board said we want to be done with it right now, then you know we could make up $2,100 and adding some additional revenue. But like I said, I'll pass it over to the board members.
Mm-hmm. I think there's places where there's cuts can be made to give us a little bit of edge room.
Yeah.
One of the things that Eric and I talked about this morning was, last time we decided just to put fully funding the insurance in there.
Yes.
There's Tony.
I think that'd be a good place to probably start the conversation. Yeah.
Now, Eric said that he originally, when he put 6% in there, that you originally thought it was going to be around 8%. Right.
Correct. I put 6%, anticipating an 8.5% increase.
And each percent is how much?
Roughly 22,000.
Okay.
Hey. If you
think worth my mind today.
Right here, sir.
Hang out with Dan the man.
And so this is right here is with the 100%. Covering up to 11%, correct, what we have here?
Yes, correct. Yeah, what you have in the budget right now. And honestly, there's been, since my budget proposal went out, there's been some just slight tweaks in the numbers, but each 1% is roughly around 24,000.
24?
Yeah, it's around 24,000. But yes, so what is in the budget right now fully funds the health insurance.
Okay, and you gave us some options last week.
Yeah, I can pull
option number 5.
That screen just kind of outlines, kind of some of the options that were proposed. Again, option 1 or option 2 is county pays all, employees pay all, and then 3, 4, and 5 is something in between. But they're all roughly, there's not a whole lot of huge difference in the overall cost. I mean, certainly there's some differences from individual plans, but yeah.
And option five, kind of made that as a recommendation for yourself. That looks like about a $69,000 difference between the fully funding. What is the option five there? I remember that one was a little more nuanced than the other ones.
So option five, I mean, basically there's, you know, minimal, there's a small savings for HDHP, but then there's a slight increase for employee only. And then it's, goes up a little bit based upon the cost, as you see for dual versus family plans. And, from a dual plan, well, let me start with family. Start with single. You can go down $5 if you're on an HDHP preventative, or the maximum is you go up $11 on a KA500 comprehensive. Dual, these are monthly amounts. The numbers in this red box are monthly amounts. Dual, Lois's would go up $26 a month. And the highest is if you wanted to be on the comprehensive KA500 right here going across, it would be a $50 a month increase. And then the family plans, again, the lowest HDHP is a $43 a month increase, and the highest would be is if you were on a KA500 comprehensive family plan, it would be $79 a month increase.
Do we have any statistics, or not statistics, but estimations on what that would look like, comparatively speaking, with the COLA factored in? I mean, take-home pay, just real rough estimates.
Yeah, let's just say, I don't have take-home, but let's just say, for instance, let's use maybe what is probably a lower-end salary. Let's just say $35,000 as a low-end. That's probably close to maybe the lower of what someone would be making. Times 3%, that's $1,050 times 12 if you are, if that employee has the highest plan of the family plan, that's $948. So their COLA would offset or would cover their, I should say that it's not an increase, they're neutral, they're,
they wouldn't make any money.
Correct. Their COLA is offsetting the insurance.
So 3% would be what, $1,500, and then 79 times 12 increase would be $948.
Yes, 79 times 12 is $948.
So there'd be some. I guess my thought would be the last thing you want to do is give people a raise and they're taking home less money because of health insurance. That would be my main concern. That's at the smallest value with the highest additional premium. That person would still at least be making what, around $550 more dollars at the lowest pay rate. So,
your biggest amount of people are in that single K500 plan.
Yeah, if you look to the columns right here, this shows how many people are in each individual plan, and so you have the most people. Employee only, 62 in the KA500 comprehensive. The next amount is 33 for dual, KA500 comprehensive for dual, and then 31 for KA500 comprehensive family. So those are kind of the numbers for how many people are in each plan.
So for the 62 on the, what would the, what do the five?
That would be 130.
So that'd be 11.
Two.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear
so
that.
So the KA500 comprehensive plan for a single person, $11 a month times 12 months is $132 for the year.
Correct.
That would be
$1,350 plus from this year.
Yeah. Bulk of your workers, lower-end people are probably in that.
Mm-hmm.
Because
yeah.
They probably are two working households, and they're on their own insurance because you can't write on your taxes.
We were, so you two know, just it came up the change in the personal property that Eric emailed about, so we're just talking about.
Well, I think one of the things that's going to happen with that change in the personal property, without lowering the rate, people are going to get a 10% tax decrease. Because I think that's part of the part of what happened is the rate, instead of used cars jumping 20% like they have the last 2 years, when we lowered the rate, now they're going the other direction. So even if we stay at 410,
it's a
10%, it's a 41%, 41 cent basically.
The only people might get a tax cut would be those who bought a new car, like me.
Yeah, but you're not paying on it unless you bought it before January 1.
Exactly.
So if you didn't buy it before January 1, you don't have to pay on it.
Yeah, me and the commissioner had
it's bad news, but it's good news. Because instead of going the wrong crazy direction, it's starting to come back down to earth, I guess is the best way.
Yeah. I'm thinking we won't see as much on Facebook about how it went down as we did when it went up that we...
Well, you never did. I mean, yeah. You know, people like to get on Facebook, beat your chest.
Yep.
I mean, and again, I mean, certainly, you know, if the board says we want to be at a certain dollar amount, we can back into a different plan if that's what the board wants to be at. Just remember, so next week we have a budget work session to be determined, and we would probably, again, if we don't make some decision today, which, you know, maybe there's more information coming next week, I'm not sure. You know, we would just have to make this a decision on the insurance, what the board selects by April 1st. So we'd have to have a budget work session next week, and the board would have to take action on a health plan if they don't select something today, which is fine. Like I said, if the board doesn't see something they want, if they want me to back into something based upon a dollar amount, then I could do that as well.
I can just tell you my opinion on it is, we sat here over the last couple of weeks and said we don't think we make enough money at all these, and we'll talk about doing a salary study. Then when we give a raise, if we have the ability, and I think we still have the ability, even with the bad numbers from the commissioner, to do everything that we said. Now, I say we cover it, and that's just me, because I am not real big on saying here it is, but there it goes.
Yeah.
All right, and we don't have to raise taxes to do that. And like I said, we're not raising them if we leave them the same. You're still getting a 10% discount or rebate. Well, I shouldn't say 10% because you don't know for sure exactly what it is across the board. But I'm going to guess it's probably somewhere in that range.
There's no 750 plan, or it's still just the 500 and 1,000?
500, 1,000 HDHP. So a couple of years ago, again, we had the 250, 500 and HDHP. Couple years ago, to start to try and, you know, lower the cost, we got rid of the 250 plan, and now we have the 500, the 1000, and the HDHP, and that's pretty comparable to what a lot of the localities are doing too. Those are some of the typical plans that they have.
You know, my argument in the past has been, you know, that the people that are affected the most are the ones who are also
making the moves.
Well, I mean, some of them are, but they're also getting the family plan where they have the highest increase, which, you know, is a higher burden for them for sure, but it's a higher cost for the county as well too. And you know, so some of the tough decisions that employees may have to make is, you know, do I stay inside a 500 plan or do I go to a 1,000 plan? And I don't know if we ever considered or maybe we thought and talked about it, maybe it's not possible, is to, you know, have some sort of like self-insurance pool, because you got to assume that, you know, the 500 versus 1,000, what would that number look like if the county chose to pay that out versus the savings that the county would have in a worst case scenario? It seems like probably even out, in my opinion, but that's maybe something HR could look at.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I mean, the county was self-insured previously, right? You know, back in 20, we left being self-insured, I want to say it was 2013, and I'm looking at Ms. Gillum because we were with Gateway back
around there.
And I know self-insured can mean a lot of different things. I'm just sort of really talking about that differential between the $500 and the $1,000 in terms of what does that look like, you know, because if you assume that you have, well, I mean, here we've got 150 employees or 140 employees on a 500 plan, and we only have 10 or 15 employees on a 1,000 plan. You know, but if you look at the premium differential between, you know, for the county, you know, between a $1,200 for the most expensive, it's, you know, almost $180 savings per employee per month, right? So it's a it's $1,000 savings per employee per month. So let's just take that bottom line, you got $31,000. What's the probability that you're going to use up $31,000 of the use of a deductible? I don't know the answer to that. You know, I almost never go to the doctor, so I don't use my deductible very often, right? But other people might, so.
Chris is using his for his knee right now.
Yeah.
Almost stay on the scooters.
Well, he's going to blow it. He's going to blow past his deductible.
So. So the only thing I want to throw out there is that, Mr. Sheridan, your point, I agree. Saying, hey, it happens to me all the time when we're looking at giving someone a teacher a raise, boom, and then you turn around, the health insurance goes up, and they're back to where they were. So I totally understand that. I don't think it's always a wash necessarily. I think even at the lowest salary, at the lowest salary at the highest rated plan, they're still coming out somewhat ahead. And that goes up the more the person makes. So I guess my thought process is there were some conversations last week about some additional things we wanted to take a look at. Granted, that was before we became above the line, before that number turned red, plus about $2,000. There were some things with the clerk's office we were talking about. Sheriff's office that we were talking about. Realistically, if we want to keep the tax rate level, and I'm not saying someone doesn't want to go down or come up, hypothetically, if all five of us said we want to keep the tax rate level, we would have to make a decision about switching to option 5 for the health insurance if we wanted to even have a conversation about funding some of those other things that we were taking a look at. So my thought with visiting this option 5 would be that it does free up $69,000 for us to look at other things that we could potentially fund. I think that would, if we went this route, it would cover what the clerk of court is asking for her folks, and I think it would cover the promotion and salary increases that the sheriff is asking for to the tune of $11,000, I think it was, something like that. I know it was total $120,000 because that included two new positions. So that was just my.
Maybe get that shed for Aaron as well, too.
What's that?
Maybe get that shed for Parks
and Rec. Yeah.
Well, one of the things that I'm going to bring up.
Did you want me to go back to the main sheet, or do you want me to stay here?
I think you can leave this.
Okay.
Yeah.
Before we start talking about taking away and stuff of that nature, we haven't talked about a meals tax. And that's something that we, as a board, can implement in November, I believe, correct?
Yep.
We could implement that in November.
Yep.
And if we started the meals tax, that's not trying to tax and spend. That's saying this is something that everybody around us does. Every time we eat in another county, we help bear their tax burden.
Alabama and Charlotte, so just raise theirs.
All of them. I mean, I'm telling you, like I said, I bought a sandwich for $8 and paid $9. And a good portion of that was meals tax. Now, I'm not trying to come up with new stuff, but that's something so that we can have, what's your phrase, Mr. O'Brien?
So you can be competitive with the
So we're not just leaving it just on these two.
You know, as opposed to most counties, we don't have as many levers as they do.
And on these two, personal property and real estate, the only people paying those are people that live there. If that makes sense.
My thought on the meals tax is, in essence, it is still going to be paid for mostly by the people who live here. It's to me, it's like hiding a tax. We don't have a lot of tourism. Most people eating here are the people we know. When I go in the restaurants around the lake, I know the majority of the people that are in there. Those are the people who would be paying this tax, which are the people who live here.
There's a ton that come in DWs that don't.
Yeah. And
if we open up anything at Zion's Crossroads, hopefully we'll be drunk. Like I said, I'm not trying to do to the taxpayer what I just talked about not doing to the employee. Yeah. This is just another tool in our toolbox that how many years ago was it we tried to do this?
Five years ago.
And it was my idea.
Yeah.
And we had three votes for it on the board, and if we'd have waited 6 months, we wouldn't have had to go to referendum. Now, the people did say no, but in every county that's ever put it up, it's always failed the first time. And I think if we do that, we also say, let's dedicate 1% of that. This is just off the top of my head.
My counter to that is your real estate and personal property tax is 100% Fluvanna County people. Your meals tax will not be 100%.
Yeah, that's what I just said a second ago.
And your personal property and real estate, you don't have a choice. You need a house, you need a car. The people who eat out, that's a personal choice. So they make the choice that they want to engage with that tax.
I'll counter that and say, from the business perspective, you know, I go into Sal's every Saturday. It's my cheat day. I get myself a mini cheese pizza and go home and take a long nap, right? But I talk to Rosario a lot when I'm in there, and the price of food has continuously gone. I mean, he said what he used to be spending $2,000 on per month, he's spending $6,000. So I don't necessarily think you also have to look at it from the citizen perspective. Yes, there is a choice, but there is no choice for the business owner who is inevitably going to again increase his prices in the face of inflation and the things that the cost of food prices and things that are going on right now. And that's going to eventually be passed on to the consumer. So they're going to then, it's going to cost even more to go out to eat. And what if it in turn hurts businesses, which then robs Peter to pay Paul because less people are going out to eat and there's less sales.
But the meals tax, unlike Europe where it's a value-added tax, your sales tax and your meals tax is not appearing on the menu. The price on the menu does not include sales tax or meals tax.
It's a pass-through tax. So yes. In other words, they're not. It's not coming out of the business owner's pocket. He's just charging you for the tax, and he's got to collect
it. He's got to remit
it.
Yeah, just like the sales tax.
You know, they deal with anyhow. So they do that for regular sales tax. They got to pay that on the regular sales tax, not the meals tax. So that it's just a pass-through. If we raise it 3 cents, then it's 3 cents that's collected from the individual per dollar. You also, I think, when you look at who's actually being taxed by it, yeah, some of us might be homeowners. Some of us might be renters. Some of us might be guests of renters. Some of us might be, you know, the kids of homeowners, right? So there's a lot of other people that pay into that tax. And as, you know, just in the case of Wawa alone, you know, that could easily add up to a significant sum of money. So I don't know that you're hiding a tax, as Mr. Fairchild put it. It's a tax that most people are used to paying. It's just now a tax that we're employing right here that, again, allows us, you know, to be, you know, more competitive with surrounding counties because they have the same tax. And so, you know, when people say, well, why is your, you know, real estate tax rate so much higher than everybody else? Well, because they use four other taxes that we don't use. You know, if we had those four taxes, maybe it would be a little bit more competitive. But if we don't have those, then we face the choice of saying to ourselves, well, you know, we really don't want to put out a tax increase. We don't think the people are looking for that right now. You know, but we also don't want to not provide for these core services and for these improvements here. And so we end up with these struggles. Whereas, you know, the practical reality is, what's the right thing to do in order to stay competitive as a county across the board? You know, for me, the meals tax is a pretty straightforward yes. You know.
To me, it's just another tax, and where we have the option to not spend as much, such as not paying for 100% of insurance, instead we're going to tax the people. And I just don't. I mean, at NFS we deal with that, of course, every year. Insurance rates going up, and you know people get raises, and people get. Sometimes they get to pay more on insurance. And the taxpayers are, I'd say the majority of them are experiencing the same. And ultimately that's where the money's coming from. So we're gonna raise taxes on them, so, and they're having the same types of increases at their work.
So, and bringing that up, Mr. Sheridan, I assume, or was it Mr. O'Brien? I think it was you that brought it back.
I brought it
back just now. It would seem to me that it would be, we got into this a few weeks ago, that it would be somewhat speculative if you thought you had three votes for a meals tax, or are you suggesting that we should include that in the potential revenues?
I'm saying we have to think about that. But I'm also going to talk about, I don't think we can we?
What's that?
Because we haven't passed it yet. We can't include it.
Well, we did that with the rate fees for applications, I mean, and stuff like that.
You could. You would be somewhat speculative.
If you didn't do it, you'd fund it out of fund balance.
Yeah.
It'd only be part of the year.
So. Yeah, it would only, yeah, you'd only,
well, you'd only be looking at. No, I know. I'm sorry.
Honestly, I would.
Well, here's another one.
That I would say no more than 300,000.
Well, you bring that. Fund balance brings up a good point. I mean, it's already tax money that people have paid, and it's there. I mean, I'm not saying this is where I'm at, but someone brought up fund balance. I mean, if we were going to speculatively say meals tax doesn't pass, then we pay whatever, you know, is there out of fund balance. Is fund balance something that we could use to say, hey, you know, within the budget, we want to do this, but, you know, because I guess my thought process is if you're going to turn around and tax people on meals tax in order to fully cover what we're talking about here in this conversation, there's money out there that they've already paid in taxes that it could be used for rather than turning around and taxing. And I get that the meals tax is a larger conversation to have about more than just this particular discussion.
Yeah, the use of fund balance to reduce the tax rate during budget season is generally not a good idea. I mean, it's not something that you want to get in the habit of doing. I mean, I'm not saying it hasn't happened, but it's generally, you know, not considered the best way to go about doing it, because it is a sort of a one-time hit, and it's taking it away from, you know, your piggy bank, which in theory you're putting aside for CIP projects.
Yes.
Our CIP projects were all fully funded and everything was running perfectly fine, then you could argue that might be a good way to go about it, but you don't know. And I remember a few years back when the economy took a real sour turn and Virginia government was wondering whether they're going to pay their bills or not, and that's when the fund balance comes into play as far as that goes. So, you know, it's not a game you want to play. Now, the difference between $50,000 out of fund balance,
right,
because we do the meals tax or don't do the meals tax, that's kind of pretty small if you're going to, quote, make that based on the way the numbers are happening here. But that's, I have to say that's in general we avoid it.
Well, I've got another spot I brought up at the last meeting. And how much do we have in there for the fire chief position?
100K.
About 100, 110.
I was going to say probably more than that when you add in everything, because if we're going to hire somebody, you probably want to pay somebody 90.
It might be more. I mean, it might be 120.
I think it's 120. All right. There's if we don't do that, and I've been a proponent of doing it, but I also know this is a lean year, and this is one of those things where there's $120,000. How much did you say it was for the insurance and the sheriff's department?
Did you mean the clerk's request?
Or the clerk's request. Yeah.
About $7,000.
I think it was.
The clerk was $44,000 and some change.
What was the other one?
The sheriff's one.
Well, and the sheriff's was to the tune of $245,000, but if you break that down, there is an $11,000 line item in there, if I recall, for
two positions.
For two positions to have.
A sergeant and a lieutenant.
Yeah. Which, when you're talking competitive and, you know, you at least give those individuals the opportunity and you take us, it might be a small hit, but I mean, if getting those people where they should or the sheriff would like to see them be, and that helps retention, then all of a sudden you're having less of a supply issue because you don't have quite the turnover issue. So that was my only thought process. I mean, I know, what is it, $245,000 is way bigger than what we're talking about. What was the one position? I think I saw it in my budget book.
For the sheriff's department, it's 83,032 for one position. Now that's just the position, and then down below there's all of the equipment and other stuff that goes with one position. And so
I was talking about the promotions, I guess.
The promotions, those are 11,853. That's it.
So
was, I guess my point there was if you look at the 69 that you would be saving, you're, you know, looking at two departments that have made requests and say, hey, we may not be able to do everything, but we can help you out a little bit. My only thing is that I'm trying to suggest is that it gives us more flexibility. If we don't want to raise the tax rate, which I don't, then it gives us flexibility to scratch some other itches if we were to look at option five.
And like I pointed out, with the dropping of Kelly Blue Book, if we keep the rates the exact same, it's a tax decrease.
Right, but and what I'm saying is that if we're all comfortable being flat, okay, and I don't know where everybody's at. I know I'm the only thing I'm super not comfortable is coming above, okay. But if we're all comfortable being flat, my point being is if we look at option five for the health insurance, it allows us to scratch two other itches that came up last week. It was simply throwing it out there that we could look at two of those things. And we talked about, you know, we had the constitutional officers in front of us a few weeks ago, and a lot of them talking about, you know, retention and trying to keep folks. And here we have two of them with requests out there that could be funded if we were to go a different way on something else. Maybe it's not from health insurance. Maybe it's from something else. I don't know.
I think we've talked about this so many times over the years about, you know, basically the health insurance and the impact of it. I've been sort of a proponent of there is a percentage that the employee pays, that's not been the way we've kind of done. We've kind of adjusted to try to meet where somebody is in the middle and made a lot of changes, and there's a lot of work that goes into that, and I think it's, you know, done it with the right intention. But if you basically told employees, you know, you're going to pay 5% of your employee cost and you're paying your family cost, you know, then that's what they know they're going to get at that point in time. And then every year that happens. Now, some years, and maybe we cap it, but some years, for example, we might have a 14 or 15% health insurance increase. And then we wouldn't be talking about, you know, $206,000? We might be talking about $400,000 or, you know, $350,000. And so what do you do then? You do the same thing, absorb it in, you know, okay, that's a significant amount that you're absorbing in at that point in time. So to me, there's an aspect of creating a consistency for the employee that they understand that, yes, it's a benefit, but it's not going to vary too much, and they can expect that they're going to have, and I'm not saying 5% is the right number, but they can expect that a certain percentage is going to be coming out of their pocket as the health insurance premiums come up. I think talk about that 80-20 there.
I think Mr. Sheridan has a good point there. If we have 100,000 wedge in there for a fire chief with no intention of any time in the near term doing it, take the wedge out and give us the 100,000, make the line go green on the items that Mr. Goad likes, and we can still stay flat.
It's and one still way fund the insurance.
Yeah.
You're saying fully fund the insurance.
Yeah.
It's another way to do it. And then the citizens still get their tax break because of the lower valuations.
We're not going to set the tax rate tonight,
no.
But we have to come up with a number that is our high point.
Yeah.
We have to come up with our high point.
Yeah. Yes.
And the problem is just coming out, and I thought we were going to be able to come out and just say the same numbers, we have to say flat and then go down. But Kelly Blue Book kind of did that for us, if that makes sense.
But we set the tax rate after the hearing in the regular meeting, right?
No, just to advertise.
The action to advertise a tax rate and a budget gets set at the 6 o'clock meeting.
Yeah. So the only thing we don't want to do is set a tax rate
too low.
Let's say they all of a sudden they came out and said, "Whoops, we made a mistake and we missed $1 million," right?
Or $350,000. Then we got to pay that out of fund balance. One penny, just advertising.
$300.
Yeah, $370 and. So that's the only thing I'm saying. That's one thing that we have to think about right now is, yes, I came to y'all and I was so excited. I thought we were going to be able to do all that other stuff. The numbers didn't come out quite exactly right, but we're still going to be able to stay flat.
Well, I think there's general consensus that we can accomplish these things, you know, across the board. I mean, I suspect that you want to take a vote on these, you know, two or three things that we're talking about right now, you'd probably get three votes one way or another, right? So I don't know that there's a lot of hand-wringing necessarily going on about this at this point in time. we don't have to decide it, and we may have some better news that comes out that says, okay, well, we can do this. To me, it's a conceptual aspect of, you know, what we have this conversation about health insurance every year. Conceptually, you know, I think that we should come to some sort of place where we say this is the formula that we're going to use going forward.
I think we have enough options, enough roads in front of us that we can take to get to the same objective. That it's just which path we take. Where, like what you said, Mr. O'Brien, three of us, let's go down this road, and you know, maybe it forks and diverges back, but I think we have options where everyone can come out a winner.
And will the assessment increases occur mid-year?
No,
that sounds all next mug year. Yep.
I don't know if we got that half-year benefit.
Next year is the one.
Yep.
Then we'll get the half-year benefit.
Yeah, next year is the one. This is the lean year. Next year, we'll be able to sit here and talk about a equalized rate where we can lower the tax rate. But that would be my only suggestion is I wanted to come in here and say the exact same ones. If we do that, there's not margin for error. So if a mistake is made, we gotta cut places.
If I can give the board just one update too, just about CIP really quick. I know there was a discussion about some of the CIP items. I did speak to the representative from one of the
Pierce
today. And basically to quote him is, what did he say? To sum it up, basically it would be impossible to guarantee that the trucks are gonna be able to make it under that price. He's like, right now they're planning out trucks 2 years from now. And he's like, by the time those trucks come in, that's gonna be into that new EPA standard. He's like, there's a few, I use the word with them like some cookie cutter or almost demo things that are ready to go at some point. He's like, those are even few and far between at this point. He's like, it's very unlikely that you're going to meet that EPA cutoff right now.
And did you give an update on this? I don't really.
I have not.
Were you going to give an update on this?
I can. I was just.
Oh my God. All right. The Tony O'Brien.
We got a close session.
This is a
Tony O'Brien
conversation here.
Hey.
Yeah.
Where'd you put it?
Oh no, we lost it. Sorry.
So I think it's always important when we are looking at the tax rate that we have some historical perspective. And
that's it.
The historical perspective would be that if you just adjusted for inflation, the tax rate that we had back in, what was the year, 1978, is that what you have there?
Yep.
That if all you did was just adjust for inflation, it would be a tax rate of $2.65 or almost $2.80 or something like that.
It's $2.78.
$2.80. So when people think that their taxes have been skyrocketing, put it in that perspective, I think it's a little different. Your house certainly in 1978 didn't cost $400,000. Your car didn't cost $50,000. So it's an important note when we sit there and we struggle and say, oh my gosh, do we have to raise taxes this year? Well, sometimes you have to raise taxes to do the right things. So I just leave it at that.
It's also, I was saying to Mike Goad, you know, we talk about, well, you know, if we can flat rate it this year, but it's all one, you know, the taxpayers remember the past year when it was an incredible increase. And so I don't look at it just what do we do this year. I look at it and how we're trending, and I think it's pretty, which I know everybody agrees, after the increase last year, I think it's pretty important. So relief this year, I think those two go together.
The one thing I'll say to that is I bring up my class I took, and I'm not going to call out the county, but they gave us a budget that we had to prepare. And the first thing I did was look at them and say, all right, tell me what the equalized tax rate is. We don't talk about that very much. They all keep their tax rate the exact same. So we do a great job of letting our constituents know. Here's what the equalized rate is.
Yes.
And we don't have fluff built in ours. You know, we can't, we're not charging 84 cents and living off a 77 cent budget and pocketing 7 cents of excess. And other counties, I hate to say that, are doing that.
Awesome.
Most all of them do that. That's why they're able to stay at that exact same rate all the time. I mean, I talked to the guy that was putting the thing on. Their real estate went up higher than ours. They were going to cut their rate by one penny. The equalized rate was 14 cents lower.
Charlottesville and Omaha.
And they were pocketing $30 million. And I was like...
Yeah, Charlottesville and Omaha assess every year.
Right next door.
So every year they just assess and pretty much they come in. Sometimes they still raise the tax rate a little bit. But for the most part...
And I'm not trying to badmouth Louisa, but their stays the exact same, right?
Yeah.
Their stays the exact same. But that's because they had a 15% increase last year in their tax rate.
Well, they got businesses too.
I'm just looking at the real estate side of it. If they kept it at 72, that was a 15% increase in their tax rate.
I think
we went up 5%.
I think to Mr. Fairchild's point, I mean, yes, you can look at it and say, okay, what is the burden? I mean, I don't recall us raising taxes that much last year, but.
Went from what, 77 to 84?
So you went up 10 to 11%.
I think our
I think Mr. Fairchild's close. I think he is
because exactly. With the tax, the real estate assessments went up like 12%. Yeah.
7 cents of 77 is 10 cents.
Okay. Right.
Yeah.
So we went up 10%, but we didn't go up 15%.
No.
Like our neighbors did. You know, people look at us, go, "Oh, you raised the taxes," because we educated them about where the equalized rate was. Everybody else just left it the same.
But ultimately, the Nirvana goal would be you set a sustainable rate, you know, and you know that sustainable rate is something that you can count on and report. Maybe you make some tweaks every once in a while, but for the most part, it's just a sustainable rate that's meeting the goals of the county. I mean, well, I'm not going to ask the school board, but I got a letter from one of our constituents, and he's like, you know, stop doing something with solar. No, he used a more colorful phrase than that. He said, "Yeah, have you looked at the schools? You know how terrible shape these schools are in? Mold coming from the ceilings. The fields are a joke. You know, it's an embarrassment. How do we stand in comparison to the other counties? You know, we're going to have to deal with a new school probably pretty soon. We've got a 50, 60-year-old plus school that is not in the best shape. You know, these kinds of challenges facing, and so when you look ahead, if you don't want to repeat what we did in 2012, you got to plan for that, right? You know, I used to joke with Mr. Weaver all the time and said, you know, so everybody's complaining about the new tax rate increase that came because of the schools, but how much money were you saving in advance to pay for those schools? You know,
not
well, if you look at the tax rate right there, if it just stays at 63 or 64 cents, but we dropped it to 48, we dropped it to 50. Then you could have put money away. And the one I look at, guys, is 78, 79, 80, and 81. Goochland did the exact same thing when they built their school. There's a monstrous tax increase right there. And I'm not saying we increased taxes monstrously, but for 3 years, people bit the bullet so we could pay off the new high school.
And as far as the new high school. Yeah, I think a lot of the the one out of 53.
Oh, yeah.
And it's either here or there to what we're doing now, but the concerns that I heard was more from the cost than people having to see a tax increase. It was just the amount of it.
I mean, it opened up. What year did we open up that school?
2000.
But we signed the paper.
11 or 12.
I was thinking 11.
Yeah. We opened it up back then, but the tax rate never increased. Because they just paid the interest.
I thought they were talking about mothballing it, but I didn't realize that they had already opened it up when they were talking about mothballing it.
Yeah, Ben was like
My daughter was there the first year that it opened.
My son was there the first year. He did his sophomore year there,
yeah.
So.
She was in eighth grade when it first opened.
Or then were there? I don't know, I think they're freshmen.
Yeah.
Our son, 11 or 12. Whichever year it was. I'm not here to throw stones, but I think we're going to be really close to flat level and do what we want to do. And I think the meals tax is just something that down the road, if we do that in November, well, that's another tool in our tool chest. And it's not, like I said, I'm not trying to, there's nobody that eats more times at EW's than me. I promise you that right now. In the state of Virginia, there's nobody that eats there unless it's Wade. And that's because he owns it. It's just one of those things.
I just, on the meals tax, I think it's too far out for us to start thinking about that in regards to this. There's a lot of conversation to be had.
I think we need to be cognizant of time also.
Yeah.
We need to have a quick close session, get back, do some items.
And two, whatever we do, we're going to need for the finance folks, whenever this is done, they're going to have to plug in all the numbers and get all the things ready to go. So for the meeting.
I would recommend that we play it safe and put a 1 cent increase over what we're currently looking at. So where are we at?
84.4.
Just do 85.5 and advertise it. Doesn't mean that we're going to go to 85.5. Doesn't change anything. I think there's a lot of consensus saying we pretty much end up here. I'm pretty sure you find 3 votes to end up where you are right now. So.
Are we doing that? We're not doing that until the regular meeting.
We need to know what you need to do because I need to make the changes, and then we need to make sure that this number is zero, whatever it is, okay. Whatever we do.
I'm comfortable with keeping it where it's at.
You've got to get it green.
What's that?
You got to get that top number green, adjusted budget balance.
The 2100, I mean, I could plug in.
That's it.
I can plug in, I don't know, I mean.
You can plug in 5,000 right there and it turns green.
I can plug
make 21. It 120 on real estate.
Yeah, I mean, I could plug in, 2,100 in one of these numbers and I'm sure it would probably be.
I would prefer not to advertise an increase.
I'd be surprised how many people come running out.
Come running out?
Yeah, and you can raise it to 85.5.
Yeah.
Or 85.4.
Yeah, they'll be banging down the door.
Or just 85 would cover it. I mean, I'm just saying, I just don't want to see us have a mistake made somewhere because we had that happen last year. And then we got to find a penny or 2 pennies. That's the only thing. I'm saying to have wiggle room. We can find it.
You can take it from the old hands. It's probably the way to go about it.
From what?
The old hands. The guys that have been around for 10 years.
Right? I don't know about all that. That's just, and like I said, this is just advertised. I mean, we've been in here and advertised 7 cents higher before.
Don Weaver was here 32 years. I think he was set to keep it flat.
Yeah.
I think he, be honest with you, if we'd have been this close and this tight and said, hey, let's just have 1 penny of leeway that we're not planning on using, but we got it there in case there's a number screw up somewhere. I don't think he'd have had a problem with that.
My only concern is you published that and, we talk hypotheticals of if we were okay with this, well, then all of a sudden what we're hypothetically okay with raises another cent and a half. And it's like, starts playing in your mind that you've got this. I understand where you're coming from on the leeway. And I know that it's just a published rate, but I think it's, does display some level of saying that, hey, I'm willing to go here, and I'm not 100% sure that I'd be willing to go there at the end of the day.
Well, I'm not willing to go there, but I also don't want to sit here and tie our hands so that we have to say, all right, we got to cut this.
I think we have flexibility in some items for some cuts, and it might go beyond our comfort zone, but I think our collections on real estate taxes are going to stay. I know we said we didn't want to go so too much on that. My only point is if in the end if we had to make some adjustments, I think there are some places both on the revenue and expense side to make adjustments. So that's why I'd be comfortable with the 84.4.
Can we do that?
Can you do what?
Adjust our revenues if we set a tax rate to make up the difference? Mr. Whitten?
Yeah,
if we can do that, I mean, that's fine.
Well, I mean, so again, if you're advertising a tax rate, just know you cannot go up from that tax rate.
Yeah. But we can do the revenues. We could make the other revenues where we adjusted last week.
You could increase the revenues.
You just have to advertise the budget.
Yeah. Then that's the budget amount. But yeah, but you cannot go above the 84.4 then.
Right. Okay.
It would be an unfortunate situation we found ourselves having a conversation saying, why did we set it at that rate? Well, we could have set it at this rate because something came up that we didn't know was going to happen. So that's my opinion. Come down to Mr. Hodge, I think.
Yeah. Welcome to my seat.
I'm not even sitting in that middle seat.
I wasn't sitting in it the first 2 years either.
You know, a lot of citizens don't understand, for example, what an advertised rate is.
Yeah.
So people will see a rate, and to a lot of people, we increase the taxes.
My dilemma is this. I understand the logic of setting higher, giving yourself room for the unexpected. But in all my years in the corporate boardroom, you also know that there's times you have to do things you don't want to do. As unpleasant as they are.
Trust me, we were here during some lean years. We had to do things we did not want to do.
I understand that.
I'll just remind you about the photograph here. So.
I think what we should
advertise is the inflation adjusted rate will be.
I appreciate this, but I
might need another person to answer the phone then ever to do that.
These statistics would not be right because if we raised our rate up to the 1978 adjusted one, that sucking sound would be people moving to Albemarle and Charlottesville for the tax rate.
Yeah, so they absorb all their property increases.
Yeah, I'm sure I could find statistics that would tell you how wonderful we are.
Mr. Fairchild would be happy all the people would leave.
So
I knew that was going to be said. Your,
I get the sensation that there's two at 84.4 and two at 85.5. Can we find
go 85.
And go 85. Could we all agree to that?
As long as we can do
that. That gives you some wiggle room. And we know we've got the knife that we can use to make cuts.
We have that 84.4 too, though.
Being able to do that other stuff, you were comfortable with 84.4, right?
Yeah, but we don't know if we're going to have a surprise somewhere. Numbers have been known to be wrong.
Well, I mean, God love my...
Is Brewery Creek going to be discussed tonight? No. No, when is that supposed to be discussed?
Sir, Kelly, can you...
If you contact the county offices, yeah, you'll probably be able to get that answered, sir.
Thank you.
What was I going to say? Those items were the buffer for if we stayed at 84.4, those items were the buffer for if there were unforeseens.
Well, that was when I thought we had $360,000 in our pocket.
All right.
The increase is on. You said you have made up your mind?
Yes.
So, you want to make a motion?
We don't make it now.
I just need to know what the dollar amount, the amount is, because I need to plug
it
in.
He needs to put it on the motion, right?
Yeah.
Well, there's no motion for this.
But there will be in the
There will be at the next thing.
So you need a number for that motion, right?
Mr. Hodge?
Yes.
84.4. We'll go with it, and if we have to make cuts, we make cuts.
Well, if we can also adjust our revenues.
Let me just clarify. This budget amount, unless you're changing revenues, you cannot go above the budget amount.
$2,200 into the one of those lines. So are y'all okay with that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, oh man, you're gonna get exactly zero. That's my boy.
That's fine. There's places we can make cuts.
Session and
I can think of two or three things.
One of the things
we added on at the last meeting.
One of the things that I brought up before was the grants writer stuff. And there may not be an appetite for that. But if we adjust up, if we do away with the fire chief position, you know, and I'm not trying to put one office in front of another. I just know what the response will be from other offices if we adjust one office. And I would rather do it all at once, if that makes sense.
My thought process is if you can get one out of the way, it doesn't all hit you at once. But I see what you're saying.
I'm telling you right now, it won't all hit you at once, but there'll be a whole lot of conversations.
Yeah.
As soon as you adjust one and not take a look at the others.
So this budget's good. So then, I mean, unless there's, and again, I'm not trying to.
I just want to make adjustments.
Up until the day we adopt it.
Up until the day, and we just can't go above that rate, tax rate.
Right. Yes.
Yep. So again, they're going to plug in all the numbers at 844, 410 for personal property residential, 290 personal property business, public utilities, and $1.90 machinery and tools, and everything else that's in their
book. And I'm going to bet you right now, we got until, when do we do this? What day?
April 20th.
When we adopt the budget?
When we adopt the budget. I'll guarantee you by April 15th, there'll be another. I haven't looked at my back of my book. We've been averaging how many houses being built? So if you got another month of houses to go on the books. So you're probably looking at another 20,000, 25,000.
Okay. Well, we're at a rate, right?
Yes. Yep.
All right. And Tony, I would tell that person about the solar that we can walk and chew gum at the same time. Emailed you saying that not to think about it.
I don't hear us talking about the schools. Until we prove that, then I don't know. Mr. Chair, I move the Savannah County Board of Supervisors enter into a closed meeting pursuant to the provisions of Section 2.2.3711A1, Section 2.2.3711A5, Section 2.2.3711A7, Section 2.2.3711A8. Of the Code of Virginia 1950 as amended for the purposes of discussing personnel, employees of the Public Works Department, prospective industry, prospective business updates in the Columbia, Cunningham, and Fort Union District, litigation, Gate Plaza, legal matters, collection of delinquent taxes, Chamber of Commerce.
Second. Motion made by Mr. O'Brien, seconded by Mr. Goode. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Chair votes aye. 5-0.
I move the closed meeting be adjourned and the Savannah County Board of Supervisors convene again in open session. Be it resolved, the Board of Supervisors does hereby certify the investigation. One only public business matters lawfully exempted from OCE requirements. Section 2.2-3711A of the Code of Virginia 1950 as amended, and two only such public business matters as were identified in the motion by which the closed meeting was convened.
Have a motion. Second. And this is the one we have to do.
Yes.
Roll call.
Individual.
So roll call. Mr. O'Brien made the motion. Mr. Hodge made second the motion. And then what's your vote?
Mr. Hodge votes aye. Mr. Goode votes aye.
Mr. Sheridan votes aye.
Aye.
Aye. We have 5-0.
Just got to find my name.
Okay. Do you need a new count?
No.
You're good, aren't
you? Yeah,
you got it right. Yeah. All right. Let's have a pledge of allegiance, please.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Adoption of the agenda.
Okay.
Move to adopt the agenda.
Second.
Sheridan made the motion to adopt. Hodge seconded. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Anybody opposed? Chair votes aye. 5-0. County Administrator?
Yep. Mr. Chair, members of the board, just got a few things to report. One, want to announce Michael Carey, a new, actually came back to E911 as a E911 communication officer. He started on March 18th. I want to welcome Mike Carey back to the county. A little update on road closure here, and this is going to be, you all will probably hear a little bit something about this. So VDOT will be closing a portion of Route 15 for pipe replacement. So the area of the pipe replacement is located near the Lions Club Baseball Park, Route 15 and 8246 James Madison Highway, which is right around the intersection of Route 672 or Carey's Creek Road. Work will begin on around 7 p.m. March 24th and is anticipated to be completed on or around March 25th. So it's going to be a complete closure of the road. This will be a continuous 24-hour operation until completed. Signs and message board will be in place for the detour. And so again, the yellow star reflects where the road is closing. And so basically, let's just say you're coming from, you normally are coming from, somewhere on Route 6 from Columbia and you're driving up to Zion. You're going to have to take, six to 15 to 6 going towards Scottsville and then take Hayden Martin Road all the way around. I mean, obviously, if you're a private individual, if you know a shorter route, you can do that.
Go through Wilmington.
The reason that this route is in place, as VDOT said, is they have to provide for the biggest impact, which is tractor trailer trucks. So, I mean, certainly from other avenues, if a local citizen knows of a different way, they can take a different way. But that's the route that they are posting for the detour. And you know, I had a long conversation with Scott Thornton today about it. Can we just close one lane and let traffic go through? You know, basically the reason for it is there was in that culvert there is such a large void going through that culvert that they had to do some remediation to fill it in temporarily because it's affecting both sides of the road. They're concerned if they only did one lane, started doing the work, and then allowed vehicles to come through the other lane, that it could potentially
It could be
detrimental to their employees or anyone driving over that. So they are going to be closing down Route 15 starting this Sunday at 7 p.m.
Have we talked to fire and rescue about this?
Yes, I know.
Be a huge impact on.
Yeah, I know. Ms. Smith has talked to some of the folks. I think Chief Mayo has actually spoke directly to VDOT. I've been in communication with the schools because the schools weren't aware today either. I spoke to Mr. Stribling and sent him and Dr. Gretz some information as well. So,
can you email me and anybody else who wants that slide?
Yeah,
and I'd like to share it on social media so people know.
Yeah, and we're going to put something out too on the county page, and I think VDOT's original map wasn't the best, and so they're supposed to be redoing that. I'm not sure if it came through yet, but if not, we will certainly get you this information out.
You might have said I missed it. How long are they estimating this will take?
So they're estimating from 7 p.m. Sunday until approximately a.m. Tuesday morning.
So the signs kind of make it seem like road work's going to be being done 7 p.m. to 7 a.m. during those nights, and that you'd be able to traverse the roads during the day, but it's a complete shutdown for 72 hours.
It is a complete shutdown.
And they couldn't do that over the weekend to avoid...
No, because what VDOT said, because I asked the same question, I said, couldn't you do it like starting earlier over the weekend? They said that the road is traveled more during the weekend than it is on Monday. Monday is the lightest... Sunday to Monday is the lightest traveled route in that section.
The one thing I will say is if they could put it off a week, then the kids are on spring break. It would not affect the schools.
That's a good point.
I thought it was going to be open during the daytime, but unlike Mr. Goad, I thought it was just going to be a nighttime
thing. And if you can talk to them, if that's going to be the case that it is, which obviously it sounds like it is, it'd be nice to them, maybe have those signs complete. Am I wrong, or did I just read them driving by yesterday? Seemed like it was just going to be night work.
I read them. I thought the same thing.
You said Kelly said the same thing?
They changed the signs?
They did change the signs this evening. Okay. All right. Thanks, Chief.
So they must have gotten some feedback. A lot of feedback in the numerous ways.
I mean,
we can reach out and Ms. Harris, do you think you could just send Scott Thornton a quick email while we're during this meeting to see if there's any consideration for that?
Yep.
So that's that. On a lighter note, Fluvanna County Parks and Rec presents the 2024 annual Easter Egg Hunt at Pleasant Grove. Again, it's free ages 12 and younger, 10 a.m. Saturday, March 30th. Please arrive early. The hunt begins promptly at 10, and the hunt ends when the last egg is found. Bring your own basket, and as anyone has ever been there, it's a mad dash to get Easter eggs. So good time had by all. And then just some up and coming meetings. So next week, March 27th at 5:30, we have a scheduled budget work session. It's to be determined in the Morris Room. Do we want to continue and have that budget work session at that time?
Thoughts?
Are we going to have anything compelling between that and the next one? Or I guess we would do one or the other. Is that what you're thinking?
Do
you think we can hammer it out on April the 3rd, or do we need the 27th? I think we can probably finish it on April the 3rd.
I agree.
We just stay there until we have to. Okay. We'd say it that way, and that way we don't have one on March 27th.
Yep, I agree.
Works for me.
Okay.
All right. Damn, that was easy.
We'll make that change. That's all I have to report.
Yeah, fine.
Screen is frozen on Zoom.
All right. We're going to move on to public comment number one. Anyone wishing to address the board should come to the podium, state your name and address. Please remember to keep your comments to 5 minutes on topic directed to the board. Anybody wishing to make comment?
I'm Curtis Putnam. 16408 James Madison Highway. I'm in the Columbia District. I'm speaking to oppose the language in Resolution 15-2024 that would remove utility scale solar generation from A1 as a use allowed by special permit. I reviewed the meeting last meeting at March 6th, and I didn't see any enthusiastic support for that language in there. In fact, I saw considerable reasons why we shouldn't have it in there. And there's an old story about a family that went to Abilene, if you've heard it. The father says, well, let's go to Abilene. Everybody says, okay, let's go. And they get in the car and they drive 2 hours to Abilene, and they get there and they go, why did we come here? And nobody knew. Okay? And I don't want us to get to Abilene. If we wish to send a message to Richmond about an ill-considered bill that is up for review, there are better ways to do this. We can have a referendum, we can do a petition drive, we can do any sorts of things, but I don't think we need to put this sort of language out there. There's many reasons not to include the language, and I think it was Mr. O'Brien said several of these, and I just want to reiterate. Firstly, it's excessively restricting. There's no need to ban all utility-scale solar from A1. There's just no reason to do. The board has the power to say when and where that development comes. It ignores the property rights of individuals. Okay, we have farmers who are aging out. Okay. People my age, I'm at the tail end of baby boomers, and I wouldn't want to be out there working a farm at my age, you know. And I might want to leave something for my family. I might want to leave a solar farm that's going to generate a good income for the family that doesn't really want to farm my land. Plus, it's going to lose millions of dollars in revenue from taxes and fees. Okay? We're going to lose that revenue if we just totally ban it. Someday we might wish that we had distributed generation. You know, we've got a couple of really good power generators in the county. And if one or two of them had to shut down for some reason, you might want to run your air conditioner. Of course, it sends the wrong signal to potential solar developers that we don't want it here at all. Okay, and that's a bad move for economic development, because when a developer comes to open a business in Fluvanna County, he's going to want to know that we have plenty of power to run his business. So it's also time, like I said, to do something positive for the farmers, because where these utility scales are going to be located are within a couple miles of a transmission line on a 40 to 50 acre plot. That's about minimum for a utility scale. And that's going to be generating about $21,000 income per acre every year. Now this is something nice to leave your family. And it's not something that a farmer can do on his own. He's going to have somebody put up that $500,000 per acre to put that solar farm in. What we do need is to adopt common sense regulations that would protect our scenic nature, water quality, and protect landowners from exploitation. Because I've talked to some people, they would love to have a solar generating farm on their property, but they want to know that that farm is going to be taken care of for 30 years, 20, 30 years, and that there's going to be some way to put the land back when it's all done. And that's where the regulations come in. I see a good purpose for all that. But I would urge you to table this resolution until the prohibition of utility scale solar in A1 is removed from it. Please strike the language about a prohibition. Thank you.
Anyone else want to comment?
Good evening. My name is James Kelly, 363 Manor Boulevard, Palmyra, Virginia, 22963. Obviously, it's a long season. Some years it feels like I spend more time here than I do at home. I just wanted to congratulate you all on a milestone that you're going to set in a couple of minutes in terms of setting the tax rate. I've obviously was a bit late today, but it's clear that you all have a direction and we are moving along through this process. I want to thank you for the time that we spent together a couple of weeks ago, where we really went through our budget proposal, for the thoughtful questions that you all asked, for the action items and follow-ups, both short-term and long-term. I will continue to convey that I believe that the school budget is a real communication of need from the school division. I don't think it includes all of our needs. For example, our salary study, which we have spoken about ad nauseum over the last year here, is not included because our board did not want to bake in a recurring cost into, a one-time cost into a recurring budget line. And so I hope that we can find a way to partner to make that happen. And I hope that if any of you are interested, as you look at CIP as well, if any of you are interested in setting eyes on any of the infrastructure in our buildings, literally anytime I will clear my calendar and meet you at a school and be happy to walk through. I'm confident that if I need to shake free Dr. Gretz or Dr. Stribling, we will absolutely all be there if we can. I know that Mr. O'Brien and I got an email as it relates to infrastructure in our schools, and I think that the best way that we can dispel misinformation, if it exists, or to set eyes on root cause problems is to physically be there and to be shown what it is that we're investing in, and to get to see it in context and in use for you know, where are our tax dollars going. But TLDR here is thank you so much for the time, and I know that we got a couple of weeks ahead of us still as it relates to closing out the budget cycle here, but I really appreciate the time that you've spent with us, the amount of rigor that you place on making these decisions, and as always, every one of you has my cell number. I am always available if you have questions as it relates to schools.
Great.
So, thank you.
Thank you.
I'm not hip enough to know what TLDR is.
Oh, too long didn't read.
Susie Mars, 6840 Thomas Jefferson Parkway, Palmyra, Virginia, 22963. I would like to thank you all for being proactive and realizing that we do not know enough at this point about solar. We do know and did find out with the extreme cold in some areas of this country that the electric vehicles didn't work too well, nor did the chargers. We also know and have found out that the lithium batteries can be very dangerous. I think that Mr. Lago Marcino realized that. So I would like to thank you for thinking ahead and realizing that we don't want to always be the first to do something when we might say we wish we hadn't before. I'm one of those groups of aging farmers, and my husband is. And we were approached long before, several years before, solar started coming here. We were approached right after, I guess, the Palmer solar had been put in. I did quite a bit of research, and it all sounds wonderful, the money, etc. But I said, no. You don't know what is going to be left of your land. You don't know what the runoff's going to be. And why do we acquiesce to our enemies who pollute much more than the United States? Why do we shut down our industries? What's left after 40 years of this? Fluvanna has just come up with a tourism plan, and they've gotten a book on this, they've gotten online, and why do we want acres and acres of solar panels anywhere in this county? Why do we want to have, to not know what's going to be left of our land? Why do we want to jeopardize the tourism which we have just gotten a hold of and tried to work with that? Why do we want it? There are not enough transmission lines also. And so the amount of land which might be necessary in some areas to meet up with the transmission line may mean acres more that are used so that these new transmission lines can be built. So I thank you for looking ahead for Fluvanna County, and we are some aging farmers that were on the front lines, one of the first to be approached. And we weighed the things and we decided no. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else wishing to speak? All right. Seeing no one, we'll close the first round of public comment.
And we have no appointments, do we?
Nope.
Okay. The presentation. We'll move on to action matters.
Mr. Chairman, we need to go to the public hearing status because it's 7 o'clock. Public hearings are advertised at 7 o'clock.
Oh, I see. Okay. Yeah, so we're going to move to public hearings first. And item E, public hearing to amend sections 22-4-2.1, 22-5-2.1, 22-6-2.1, 22-7-9.1, 22-8-2.1, and 22-22-1, and to enact 22-17-20 of the county code to authorize the short-term rental of residential dwellings by right in the A1, R1, R2, R3, and R4 zoning districts, subject to supplemental regulations. Mr. Wood?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. So this ordinance came before the Planning Commission, and the Planning Commission forwarded on to this board 5-0. There has been a few changes since that point that I'll go over. But basically, right now in our ordinance, we don't have short-term rentals as a use. There are short-term rentals throughout the county. If you look on Airbnb, VRBO, you'll see them throughout Levanta County. So basically, short-term rental is a provision of room or space. It can be a room in a house or the whole house for a period of less than 30 days in exchange for a charge. So next slide. And so the big change, Senate Bill 544 has been approved by the House and the Senate, hadn't been signed by the governor. He has until April 8th to consider signing it. I checked this morning, he hadn't signed it yet. So basically, what it says is that localities can't require a special use permit for the use of a residential dwelling as a short-term rental, where the dwelling unit is also legally occupied by the property owner as its primary residence. And this is only for ordinances that go into effect after December 31st, 2023. So originally, when this went to the Planning Commission recommended not allowing short-term rentals in townhouses and duplexes. But now, if this ordinance is signed by the governor and a property owner lives there as their primary dwelling, they would be able, so Sycamore Square, the townhouses to Colonial Circle, for instance, they would be able to rent them by right if it's their primary residence. So that's the big change you'll see in the ordinance. So we can regulate short-term rentals through our land use authority and the state code. It does make short-term rentals a by right use. So when we went to the Planning Commission, it was a short-term rental of a detached single-family dwelling. Now it's just a residential dwelling, which is the language from the state code. So the definition of residential dwelling, basically short-term rental of a residential dwelling is a residential dwelling that's rented for compensation for a period of less than 30 days. And then you see the 22-17-20 for the supplemental regulations. So the Planning Commission did suggest additional language at their public hearing where if there are multiple single-family detached dwellings on a farm, for instance, there could be one short-term rental for every 10 acres of land. So their worry is if you had a 300-acre farm with four houses on it, they wanted the people there to be able to rent each of those houses. So that's the Planning Commission came up with language, one for every 10 acres of land. But I did, because of the Senate Bill 544, I added language that applies to agricultural land. Because technically, a duplex is one parcel, but you could have two short-term rentals within that one parcel. So that if you look, when we get to the ordinance, you'll see where I added agricultural land. That supplemental regulation just applies to that. So talk about the next two things. You can go to the next slide. So I'll go over the supplemental regulations. There's quite a few of them. But because it's by right and not by special use permit, we want everything to be in the ordinance because there's not going to be any conditions that we can implement. So the owners do have to pay the application fee and submit the application to the Community Development Department. And then the owners provide the contact information for the owner or manager. And talked about the for detached single-family dwellings, one rental per 10 acres of land for agricultural land. And then one item where I have it drafted this way, but it's up for discussion, is for townhouses, single-family attached, and two-family dwellings, I stated it has to be legally occupied by the property owner as his primary residence. So when the Planning Commission and Board discussed this, basically they wanted to allow someone to buy a house in the county and rent it out as a short-term rental. They wanted to allow that use. But it seemed to be the consensus was they didn't want someone to come in and buy a townhouse or a duplex and rent it out. So that's why I have this language. It has to be their primary residence. But the board feels differently after the public hearing. That's something we can discuss. Because if we change that regulation, it would be less restrictive if we didn't have that language in there, if you understand.
So just to clarify, the way you have it written now, it would have to be, if it were a townhome or a multifamily, it would have to be that the person who's renting it's family primary residence?
It would have, the person who lives there, who owns it, it'd have to be their primary residence.
Okay, so in that case, they might just be renting out like a room in there or something, correct? Or
so if they rented out the, let's say Sycamore Square, if they rented that unit or they owned it and rented it out to someone else, they wouldn't be able to use it as a short-term rental.
Okay.
Because they don't, it's not their primary residence, and they...
But say it's their primary residence. Say they want to go somewhere for 2 weeks, but they want to rent out their primary residence for 2 weeks while they're gone. They could do
They could do that as long as they own it and it's their primary residence.
I was just wondering why, if it was their primary residence, they'd be using it, isn't it? But that makes sense. I see what you're saying.
People, you know, maybe they live in Florida 6 months out of the year, and they want to rent out their townhouse at Sycamore Square for 6 months out of the year. Right. So we can talk about that after we get through all the regulations to see if we want to change that. But also I have language, the short-term rental may not take place in an accessory apartment or accessory structure. We found on Airbnb there's tree houses in the county that are rented as Airbnbs. And they're very fancy tree houses, have hot tubs and electric and plumbing, but they're a tree house. They rent for $200 a night. So there should be no visible evidence of the short-term rental other than one sign, four square feet maximum. They have to comply with the Florida noise ordinance. Outdoor burning not within a designated fire pit, and use of fireworks is not allowed, so you would still be able to allow to have a fire pit. They have to comply with all health department regulations, and the maximum number of occupants would be determined according to the health department. So if you have a three-bedroom septic, you would only allow six people. The parking of the dwelling has to be in the driveways or approved parking areas. It can't be off-site yards. The property boundaries have to be marked, as if there's a lake on a neighboring property, people aren't going there and going for a swim when it's not part of the property.
But that can be just a document in the house, correct?
Yeah, it could be a map. You could have signs on the trees, or you could just have a map showing where the property boundaries are. It just has to be marked where the boundaries are. They have to comply with all state building code, fire and health and safety regulations. There has to be a fire extinguisher and smoke detectors and carbon monoxide detector.
Now you're not sharing. It had frozen.
Hold on, something more. What's going on?
It had frozen.
Okay, hold on. Hold on, you said I'm not sharing?
Now you're not sharing. I'm in.
Excuse us during the technical difficulties.
So while they resolve this, I have another question. So you mentioned that there will be registration of these with the Community Development Department.
Correct.
Will there...
Should I just move back in?
Is there going to be some kind of inspection before, or periodic inspections for carbon monoxide, smoke detectors, fire extinguishers? And who would perform that?
Are you in? So carbon monoxide detectors are required. We don't have an inspection program as part of it.
Okay.
That's not in the regulation. We can discuss that. So it is required that there be a... Are we good?
Yeah, we're good.
There, it is required they have a carbon monoxide detector on each floor and in any attached garage. And our building official did review this language. But there is not an inspection program. Some counties do that, where the building official has to go out and inspect these short-term rentals before they can be used. But that there's not... We don't have that language currently in the ordinance.
Next slide, please.
And also, the owner does have to register the rental with the Commissioner of Revenue, because now they will be collecting transient occupancy taxes. And the regulations are not intended to limit the restrictions of the owners association, so you would still couldn't have a short-term rental in Lake Monticello, because the HOA covenants prohibit it. And owners unable to meet the above requirements would be prohibited from operating the rental. So we do have some options. We could do civil penalties, criminal penalties, or an injunction if those penalties don't work. And so real quickly, I want to talk about grandfathering. So basically, the ones that are currently in use are not grandfathered because they were never allowed under the county code. So they're basically not conforming illegal uses. And so We're not at, because this is a by right use, we're not adding language that says for the existing rentals. Now, there are a couple tree houses in the county that are under this ordinance would not be allowed. So we're not grandfathering those tree houses that are currently being rented on the Airbnb, because we're saying no accessory dwellings could be rented as short-term dwellings.
Like you couldn't rent your above garage room or something like that.
But yeah, if you have a room above your garage,
correct,
or your basement. And next slide. So agritourism, we talked about this last meeting, or when we last discussed this, but I just want to bring it up again. So for instance, like Harbor Hills Winery, Prairie Hill Orchard, basically under this Attorney General opinion, because they allow members of the public to come there and it's agritourism, all the short-term rentals there would be allowed by right. So there could be an argument that this Attorney General thing is just persuasive, you know, not mandatory authority. But there's an argument if they had, you know, a tree house or, you know, a garage apartment, that it could fall under agritourism and be allowed by right.
If you have that agritourism component on your property existing,
correct,
like you're doing something.
You have to grow stuff on the property and allow activities for where the general public can come and visit. Then there could be that agritourism exemption. So that just gives in the language from the Attorney General where he talked about how it would fall under agritourism. And so were there any questions? Or we can look at the ordinance also if you want to see any language in the ordinance where it changed from what the Planning Commission.
Can you pull that up?
Staff discussed that basically we didn't think the changes were so major that they needed to go back to the Planning Commission, because it was just reflecting what the state code. It hadn't been signed at this point, but with the state, most likely it's only signed by the governor, because it was pretty overwhelmingly passed in the Senate and the House. But you can kind of look at change from detached single family dwelling to residential dwelling, because under the state code, that's the new language. And then I took out annual application, because now since it's a by right use, I thought it made more sense to just have a one-time application at the beginning. And there can be right now we haven't even designated what the fee would be. It'd be a nominal fee just for administrative time. And then you can see the language in B, where basically any parcel of multiple single family dwellings could have one short-term rental for 10 acres. So if you have 200 acres with four short-term rentals, you would be allowed that. So the one is C, where basically for townhouses, duplexes, triplexes, you have to legally occupy the residence. You have to, and also own it in order for it to be used as a short-term rental. So that's something we want to discuss and make that less restrictive. That's something we could bring up.
My only question is that would the governor's signage of that bill make that less restrictive eventually, or
no,
we could keep this even with the bill being passed?
Because his language said they had to legally occupy it and they had to own it.
Okay.
So
now say I'm a property owner and I own both units in the duplex. Could I live in one and rent the other one out?
Yeah, I talked to the planning department and we both agreed that they would be allowed to do that.
Okay.
Because that's pretty common. You put them one side and rent the other side.
Yeah, like your neighbor passes away or sells it, you just buy up the one next to it.
But if you rented out both sides, you wouldn't be allowed
right.
to rent it as a short-term rental.
Because there'd be two in the 10 acres.
Mm-hmm. And then the definition, I just changed it to residential dwelling instead of detached single-family dwelling. There's, if you go down, it shows the language in subsection D. And it's only for ordinances enacted after December 31st. So other counties that already have ordinances in effect, like Albemarle County requires special use permits. It doesn't affect their ordinances. So
you only you got a special use permit on top of this to allow an exemption as well, too.
Let's say
somebody wants to petition the board for a special use permit to have more than one house per 10 acres.
Oh, sure. You could have a process. So we had a text amendment to allow that. Yeah, we could. We could allow that.
Correct.
I'm almost afraid to ask this question.
I have questions, but I wonder if we should reserve our questions until.
We can have the public hearing first and then have questions or answer questions now, either way.
My only question is this. You talked about the tree houses. So we're saying those are not allowed?
Correct. Right now we set, the supplemental regulation says no accessory apartments and no accessory dwellings. So you can't rent out your guest house. Let's say you have a pool house, you can't rent that out. If you build a tree house, you can't rent that out under the way it's currently, the way it went to the Planning Commission.
Now the board could, if the board wanted to do that, they could.
They
could
take that out, and it, since it's less restrictive.
The only reason I bring that up is when this first started, it was because of a tree house.
Not only was it because of a tree house, that individual went through the planning department, thought they were doing all the right things, spent about $40,000 or more creating and building this tree house, and it is quite the tree house. Then we're told that no, they couldn't do this because, you know, we didn't have an ordinance allowing for short-term rentals. And then they pointed out the fact that there were some county staff members who, in fact, also had a treehouse. So the board decided to vote to not enforce until an ordinance was put in place. I suspect there's probably a few people that have garages that they fixed up and they put the top on, you know, as well, too, they can rent out, or that have, you know, something creative. I know, I think it's in Goochland, not necessarily here, but somebody had a railroad car that had been converted into an Airbnb. That's one of the things that I would have an objection to, is this, you know, a restriction that's being put in place with these particular items. But as I said, I'll reserve my questions and comments till later.
So you want to have a public hearing first, and then?
Yeah, well, I think it's useful to hear from people and see what they have to say.
You want to open up the public hearing? Everybody good? All right, we'll open up the public hearing. Please keep your comments to 5 minutes on topic and directed to the board. Anybody wish to speak?
Good evening. My name is Barbara Haynes. I don't know if this is picking me up.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. I live at 4874 Thomas Jefferson Parkway, and my husband and I are farmers. We are in the process of renovating a detached single-family home with the intention of being able to rent it out on the RVO or Airbnb. This is better?
Yeah.
There we go.
I can hear you now.
Okay. So, should I start again?
I think we got it. All
right.
Yeah.
So, I first of all want to thank the board and the Planning Commission for taking the time to research this and do the initial legwork, because I think it's something that the county desperately needs, especially with our emphasis on bringing more tourism into the county in order to preserve our rural nature. But when people come here, they need some place to stay. And I think that this is a great revenue base for the county also. We have no problem with paying taxes on the additional income. But I would like the county to consider changes to two items in the proposed code. Number one, we're talking about use permitted by agriculture A1, so not all farms are over 10 acres, but if your property is zoned A1, you by right in the definition of the code can build two detached single family homes on the property without having to subdivide it. So we are asking that either a clause be placed in there exempting farms from the 10 acre requirement, because my property is 15.67 acres that we are working on renovating, and we are working on the main house right now, but the intention later on was to build a caretaker's cottage, which could also be rented out. But by limiting it to one home per 10 acres means that the farm would then have to be 20 acres in order to be able to rent out a second home. And so we're asking that be considered, because it does limit our ability to promote agritourism and have people stay in a farm environment while visiting Fluvanna County. So the second thing that we're requesting a consideration for rephrasing is where it says that the owner shall also agree to restrict occupancy in the short-term rental to no more than two persons per lawful bedroom. I do agree that anything done with a short-term rental should meet the health code, you know, and the building code. However, I would like it to say two adults rather than two occupants, because if a family is traveling with their children, you know, say they have minor children that are traveling with them, they may want to rent someplace that is a one bedroom and have everybody stay in the same place. Or maybe you want to get together with and have a family reunion and you're going to have brothers and sisters traveling from across the country with their children and have those children stay in the bedroom with them. So I think that by saying no more than two persons per lawful bedroom, we're limiting people being able to travel with small children. And I think it should be read adult. And those are the only two considerations that we're asking the board to look at. In other words, I'm really excited about this program, code, measure, whatever it's called. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you. Anybody else wishing to speak? All right, seeing none, I guess we'll turn it back to the board for questions and comments.
What was the, do you know the number of the clause that she referenced with regard to the bedroom?
Let me close it.
Yes, that's number, subsection I. Basically, at the end of it says,
oh, you got to close the public hearing.
Yeah.
No one wishing to speak, we'll close the public hearing.
So if you look at subsection I, it says the owner shall also agree to restrict occupancy in the short-term rental to no more than two persons per lawful bedroom. So what she's requesting is to state to no more than two adults per lawful bedroom. So it's less restrictive, so you could make that change if you so desire. And then as far as the 10 acres, the Planning Commission did throw out different, I know Ms. Morgan threw out 5 acres. So if you wanted to change it to one short-term rental for 5 acres of land, that's less restrictive, so you could do that.
Could we do I'm guessing I know what the Planning Commission was referring to. If you took 200-acre farm and had 20 rentals on it, or 19 rentals.
I can't remember whether that was.
Limit the number of rentals?
I think some of the concern was, if, depending on where you were, if there were so many houses near other residents, too, I think it was a little...
There was one parcel over off 250 that had 8 rentals within less than 20 acres.
That's right.
And now, and right now they're rented long-term, but the concern was that they would start renting short-term if we didn't have that restriction. So that was the example that was brought up. But they still wanted to allow, you know, farms and agricultural uses to, you know, be able to rent the different tenant houses and main houses that were on the farm.
I think our thought was just not to have little Airbnb neighborhoods popping up.
No, that's what I'm talking about, like a cluster subdivisions of Airbnb.
What is restricted by special use then?
Well, you could allow that. Right now, there's not a special use permit process.
So
you could have that,
say,
as an option.
Yeah. Exceptions or greater density by special use only. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then that gives them the flexibility.
I find a lot of this ordinance to be overly restrictive. And I think a lot of this ultimately gets dictated by the market. As much as we want to see tourism grow in Fluvanna, I don't really see that we're going to see a lot of people coming in if we had 500 rentals here taking up the entire place. So it's a little bit of a market-driven thing from that standpoint. I think the restriction on the acreage for homes is too limiting. I think that the restriction on the other types of accessory dwelling units is too limiting. I think that, you know, part of if somebody who's trying to create an Airbnb business is that they're looking to be creative in different ways that they might go about it. So it doesn't address, for example, glamping, you know, as a basic example, just literally pitching up a tent if you want to do that. I think that you have the ability to come back to these ordinances and address them if the problem becomes, you know, of some nature. I mean, for example, you know, down at Lake Anna, they've had some real issues, but basically what the governor's put in place is, you know, basically saying, yes, you can go ahead and do what you want to do there. But the problem they had down at Lake Anna was, you know, 20, 30 people showing up to a house and partying and disturbing the neighborhood from that standpoint. And I think there's a reasonable limitation, but You know, I stayed in Airbnb just the other week. We stayed in Airbnb. It did not have that heart-shaped bed. But it did have a bedroom that had two queen beds in it. And you could certainly see four people staying in those two queen beds if you looked at it from that perspective. Are we really going to get into the business of regulating how many people are showing up into, you know, a bedroom? Again, I think that that's somewhat limited and driven by the landlord, his vision, and how he's trying to put that in. So I would be very much in favor of scrapping many of these more restrictive measures and you know, reserving those for the ability to come back again, is my opinion on this.
So like the, you mentioned that what was happening at Lake Anna, but if you don't have that, like that restriction on how many people per bedroom or something, how are you going to keep that from happening?
Yeah, I'm not, again, I think, you know, the landlord can kind of drive that. First of all, you know, there is a recreational aspect about Lake Anna. Everybody at the lake coming down, partying hard there. I don't necessarily see the same kind of thing happening, you know, at that level, but, you know, what maybe we put a number per square footage as a possibility, but I just don't see the restricting bedrooms as a either enforceable mechanism or really a smart way to go about it.
I've never been to a class at 1980s reunion for 14 and down in Brebo. You get about 45 people in a house.
And that might be the exception. I used to go to Nag's Head and there'd be 20 people, yeah. And 10 of us were sleeping out on the deck or something.
I went to spring break and I didn't even stay in my room. There were 17 people in two beds.
If we have that much agritourism happening in Brevard County, we'd probably be looking at other things from that standpoint.
The only offsetting consideration you might want to think about with that is just septic systems. I'm sure from VEH's standpoint, the septic system is put in for a certain size family and flow, and I think if you're allowing, you could potentially run into the issue of if you got, you know, six people per room and it's being rented out every night, that may not be what the system was intended for. Granted,
and then the landlord would face the repair of their septic system and make the decision. So that's
correct.
Why I say there's certain things that, you know, are sort of market driven by this. You know, if you overload it with people and, you know, you still only collected the $300 and now you have a $30,000 septic repair bill.
You brought up a good point. If you got two queen beds in a room, if you have a room big enough for two queen beds and you say you can only have two people, when you could obviously have four.
Well, and I suspect that if people really knew what was going on, for example, I'm surprised the treehouse people aren't here because they were pretty vocal about it. But I guess that there's probably a lot of people that have barns that have been renovated.
I'd like to see the treehouses. Something we could put in there. I don't know how we would do that.
I mean, you could add accessory dwelling.
You can remove that restriction. Because right now it says the use shall not take place of an accessory apartment or accessory dwelling. If you struck through that, it's less restrictive. So you could just totally, if there's a majority in favor of that, you could just remove that.
What would pay me? Somebody give me the opposite side of that.
Of what?
Accessory dwelling? If we take that out, then what's the bad side of that?
Well, yeah. My question would be, why was that restriction there in the first place, and is that worth it? I guess asking the same thing at a different angle.
I honest to goodness went home yesterday and looked up tree houses in the Shenandoah, and the third one that popped up was Palmyra. And you know, I mean, it's nice.
What were they trying to prevent by having that?
I think it's you know, excess number of people, you know, cars. So many people add that residence because you might be renting, you know, the main house plus the accessory dwelling in the back. I think that was kind of the concern. I know in Albemarle County, if you use the accessory dwelling, they require a special use permit. So for instance, like my cousin has a house and then they converted their barn to an apartment. So they would be required to have an SUP because it's an accessory dwelling. So you could also have an SUP process as well for accessory dwellings, or you could just allow them by right.
And I think that's a way to approach it, but again, I would argue that you can get back to that point if you need to. Right?
In other words,
for example, with the street house, I don't think we've had anybody complain or any letters saying from those neighbors, hey, you know, there's too much activity going on in this street house. So while I can understand those concerns, you know, by the same token, I sit there and I think, you know, our objective is to bring people to Flavanna to show them the beauty of Fluvanna, to make it easy, and you know, an Airbnb property owner participates in that process to make it attractive to come. But prices are going to be driven by the number of properties. Prices are going to be driven by the quality of properties. You know, prices and experiences and reviews are going to be driven by what people experience. That's kind of the beauty of the system, is that it does sort of self-regulate itself. And I don't know that we have to spend a lot of time regulating it. And I certainly wouldn't want to go through a bunch of SUP hearings for an accessory dwelling unit when it's not a problem today. You know, it's kind of my opinion. I'd rather strike it, and then, you know, 10 years from now, if we've got to review it, well, we can review it at that point in time.
Regarding the accessories, you said anything I don't disagree with. My only point for asking why it was there was, I'm assuming it's there for a worst case scenario, and I couldn't envision what that worst case scenario would be. So
that's why I asked my question.
Yeah, I don't have no reason to disagree with what Mr. O'Brien said there. So I mean, can we go ahead and strike?
They will strike subsection D from the supplemental regulations when you get to the motion.
Okay.
If there's any other regulations you want to discuss.
So it's only everyone was majority at least said D. I mean, so I think the other one was the 10 acres of land, which was B.
I would suggest 1 per 3 acres. That would be my suggestion.
I like the 5 that Mr. Goode said.
We moved up from 5 to 10 on the Planning Commission. Again, I think as Mr. Sheridan said, as Mr. Sheridan noted, our thought process there. And we spent a lot of time talking about that, if I recall, Dan.
We did.
And I don't remember if that was before or after I was on this board, but regardless, I mean, there was a long discussion there about, and there were some people who thought 10 was a little too much. I could definitely get on board with 5. You know, I think it definitely addresses some concerns that we may have had, and maybe we went a little bit too restrictive on 10. I think coming back to 5 would...
Well, could you put a thing in there to do if somebody had 9 acres and wanted to put 2, or put 1? What I'm saying is, could they come back with SUP?
Well, right now we don't have the SUP process. I mean, we'd have to introduce that because of text amendments.
You mentioned not having a bunch. Do you think we'd have a bunch of SUPs there? I'm kind of okay with if they come before us with an SUP and we're like, okay, this makes a lot of sense. Let's go ahead and allow this. I think I'd be okay with that.
So do we have more that have? Are there interest in 5?
Yeah. So do I understand right that it'd have to be for each of those would have to be at least 5? So in other words, you can't have 7 acres and
you have to have 10 acres for 2 short-term rentals.
Yeah, but do you count your house as part of the 10?
Yes.
So you'd only have 1 with 10 acres.
Well, that's if you're renting your house.
Oh, sure. Yeah, if you're not renting your house, if you're just renting your pool house out, you'd be allowed to do that.
Yeah, I got a pool house. It's right down next to the creek.
That's an accessory dwelling unit.
And so if we remove that restriction, then you'd be allowed to rent your house.
Which means that you can have more than 2. I mean,
so if you rent your main house and your pool house and you only have 5 acres, you wouldn't be allowed to do this.
What if you have your main house, another house, and your pool house, and you're on 8 acres?
No, I'm doing it.
You're not allowed to
do it. You'd have to have 15 acres.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. That's what I'm saying. You'd have to have 15 in order to have 3 dwellings on there. Yours, and then the other 2 you rent.
Yes. I mean, we could create a special use process that would have to go back to the Planning Commission.
That's something we could do later. Mm-hmm.
I lean on the side of, you know, is this going to become a problem and what's the market for it? And, you know, why are we favoring somebody who has 10 acres versus somebody who has 9 acres or 8 acres? You know, I think we're being a little too restrictive on this. And I get that, you know, part of the planning process is to look to the future, but, you know, ordinances can and do change with regularity. So there is nothing that is... Yeah.
So if we made it 5 tonight and we found that was the issue, we could come back and change it to 3.
Yes.
Well, you could change it to 3, or you could start with 3 and make it 5, or you could start with 4. I'm just saying, you know, you got wiggle room.
My suggestion, I mentioned it to Mr. Goode, was the reason I leant towards 5 was the Planning Commission had discussed that, and I want to take into consideration their deliberations.
I'm good with 5. I'd be concerned about going under. Again, could be likely nothing's going to happen, but...
If it becomes an issue, please come see us.
Yeah.
And I'm also in favor of having some special use. So where somebody in extraordinary circumstances with a very compelling case can come before us, and then we allow that. I think that's a...
Yeah.
It leaves you room.
We don't have to add that right now.
That'd have to be a ZBA,
no.
Right? Well,
yeah. Have to go back to the Planning Commission.
A special use permit is just a request. There's no extraordinary circumstance. Just,
yeah.
I want to do this, you know.
Yeah.
And you come here and look at it. So.
Yeah.
So it sounds like five's a number for
okay.
B.
So paragraph B, we wanted to change with five.
Yep. And then
strike D, and wasn't I,
and
to change it to adults?
Yes, the last sentence was to change it to two adults.
I go back to that. If you have two couples that travel together and there's two beds in there, all of a sudden you can't have four. Adults.
You mean a one bedroom two with two beds?
With two beds.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What's the enforcement on that?
I mean, basically you would get a complaint from the neighbor that, hey, there's this house with five cars. It's a two-bedroom house.
So that's my only purpose of, and I hear what you're saying, Mr. O'Brien. I do. My only thing is if we don't have an enforcement officer out there going enforcing this, okay, maybe everybody that stays in one, but when it does become a problem, at least we have that teeth in the ordinance to say, you have too many people in here and you need to do something about it.
If you're on 10 acres already, you know, basically, is where you're
five.
Now
five.
Well, we're also talking about in R1 and R2 and R3 and
it could be a third
and townhomes and everything as well. I mean, we're not just talking about Mr. and Mrs. Haynes' land where they have a ton of it. I mean, we're talking about Sycamore Square.
R3 could be in the lake. Well,
no,
prohibited by the HOA.
No,
and I think if you're on water and sewer, it's not big of a concern. It's if you're on well subject, it's a concern.
I think the reason they put the number of adults, and we discussed something about this, about college kids coming in and throwing a huge party.
It's a market point.
That's right. Yeah. Well, why are they going to come to Savannah and throw a huge party when they go to Lake Anna?
Because they got a pond they can go sit out. I'm not even going to throw anybody under the bus because they got a pond and a farm they can go sit out there and ain't bother nobody.
They might. Yeah, they might do that. So.
My only concern with not enumerating it in some measure is that if you do want to enforce, in the event that you ever do want to enforce something, you have no teeth there.
So I will just counter with this.
Okay.
We haven't had any enforcement. We haven't had any complaints in almost 4 or 5 years, and that's when we brought the subject up. Who knows how long this has really been going on in Fluvanna County. So just saying, just because we're not putting this regulation in place doesn't mean that all of a sudden there's going to be a wave of people coming into our VRBOs and Airbnbs here. I think, again, it's just driven by the market.
I'm not laughing at y'all. I'm not even gonna say it. It's just a dumb joke.
What?
From you? Yeah. I know a guy with a bunch of single beds in Ken's door. They're long-term ones.
Anybody else with me here, Mr. O'Brien, have an opinion on that one?
I could see it at least switching it to adults.
Yeah. Like I said, the only thing I'm thinking is if somebody has two beds in a room, you know, I don't, anyway.
Why is it that the supposed liberal on the board here is at least restrictive when it comes to business?
I actually always brought that up.
Did
next,
he say
you're going to support capitalism?
Did he say supposed liberal?
I have been supporting it.
Look, lightning can get you back.
All right, so. So we hear adults, is that what the majority of
two adults is right?
Yeah, I'm comfortable.
Okay. Any other changes?
Tony?
I think that addressed certainly the comments and some of the things the board brought.
How about the
I do have to ask one question. Let's suppose it's so bad if they gotta pull out sofa. Does that count as another bedroom?
Nobody's going to be checking it.
I mean, let's go back to
it. Kind of like, guys, nobody's coming out. There's nobody doing this. This is got, you know.
All right. I think we're ready.
Are we okay with the townhouses and duplexes? You have to be owner and it has to be your primary residence.
Yep.
Anything else before we click out of the ordinance?
Everybody done?
You want me to make a motion?
You've been making the notes with the changes. Go ahead and do it.
Just Finding that the proposed zoning ordinance amendment is appropriate for public necessity, convenience, and general welfare, and is good zoning practice, I move that the Board of Supervisors approve the amendments to the County Code to amend sections 22-4-2.1, 22-5-2.1, 22-6-2.1, 22-7-9.1, 22-8-2.1, and 22-22-1, and to enact 22-17-20 with amendments to section B, changing from 10 to 5 acres, and section I, changing the word persons to adults, and completely striking section D as listed.
So I'll second this one, because he did a much better job of reading the numbers than Mr. Fairchild.
He was reading big print, I was reading small. All right, we have motion, shared and seconded. I'll make a motion, shared and seconded. All in favor?
Aye.
Say aye. Aye. Anybody opposed? Chair votes aye. Passes 5-0. And we will move on to item F. Public hearing to amend sections 22-9-2.2, 22-10-4, 22-11-2.2, and 22-12-2.2 of the County Code to make a clerical correction that minor scale solar generation facilities are allowed by special use permit in the B1, BC, I1, and I2 zoning districts. Mr. Whitman.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the board. So back in 2021, the zoning ordinance was amended to authorize small-scale solar generation facilities as a by-right use in the A1, R1, R2, R3, R4, B1, BC, I1, I2, and MHB zoning districts. But the ordinance mistakenly also authorized small-scale solar generation facilities instead of minor-scale solar generation facilities as a use allowed by special use permit in the B1, BC, I1, and I2 zoning districts. So a small-scale solar generation facility is basically a system that produces no more than 15 kilowatts of electricity. So it's a pretty small scale. That's why it's allowed by right. And then if you look at the next definition, a minor-scale solar generation facility is less than 2 megawatts of electricity. So it's a little bigger, so that's why it makes sense that it would require a special use permit. So what the proposed ordinance would do is basically make the correction correct mistake that was made in 2021, and would state that minor scale solar generation facilities are allowed by special use permit in the B1, BC, I1, and I2 zoning districts. And the Planning Commission did hold a public hearing and recommended approval of the ordinance. But happy to answer any questions.
Any questions?
Open the public hearing.
Yep. We will now have a public hearing. Please keep your comments to 5 minutes on topic and direct it to the board. Anybody have any comments or questions? Seeing none, the board, do you have anything else to discuss or questions?
Yeah, close it. So I'll now close.
With no one else, close public hearing. No questions?
I think this makes perfect sense. And if the Planning Commission recommends it, I think we should do this.
I'll make a motion. Finding that the proposed zoning ordinance amendment is appropriate for public necessity, convenience, and general welfare, and is good zoning practice, I move that the Board of Supervisors approve the amendments to sections 22-9-2.2, 22-10-4, 22-11-2.2, and 22-12-2.2 of the County Code.
Second.
Motion made by Mr. Goad, seconded by Mr. Hodge. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Anybody opposed?
I didn't say aye, but I'm...
Did you say aye?
It's just a change. I mean, we're going to, you know, change more things, so it doesn't matter right now.
Okay.
Did everyone say aye?
Did you say aye? Or you
I did say aye.
Okay. Or are you saying just...
Anybody opposed?
Chair votes aye. 5-0.
Super.
Moving on to item G, public hearing to amend section 20-1-2.1 and to enact section 20-1-7 of the County Code to strike optional penalty language
and give the treasurer discretion for application of tax payments when there is a payment arrangement. Mr. Wood?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. So basically, Virginia Code Section 58.1, 3916 states the penalty for failure to pay a tax shall not exceed 10% of the tax past due, or $10, whichever is greater, provided the penalty shall in no case exceed the amount of tax assessable. And there's also optional language in that same code section. So we discovered that on September 16, 2020, the board actually already approved an amendment to Section 20-1-2.1 that struck the optional language that states in the case of delinquent tangible personal property taxes more than 30 days past due, the penalty shall be 25% of the tax past due on such property. So if you owed $1,000, it would be a $250 penalty. So now it would be $100 penalty. So the amendment was approved, but it was actually never codified. It was mistakenly, I think they thought it was a temporary ordinance on the person who was codifying the code. So basically now we will send that on to DND code and the changes already been made. So the proposed amendment to section 20-1-2.1 would just add the language that the penalty shall in no case exceed the amount of the tax assessable. As Virginia, so the other amendment is to section 20-1-7. And basically, Virginia Code Section 58.1-3913 states that unless otherwise provided by the board, any payment of taxes shall be credited first against the most delinquent amount. So the proposed code section would give discretion to the treasurer for the application of tax payments when there's a payment arrangement. So if someone wants to do a payment arrangement, they could credit that to the current year so they're not digging themselves in a deeper hole. So if the ordinance is approved, the treasurer could credit that payment to the recent amount due. So basically the penalty and interest wouldn't continue to bill is the reason for this ordinance. Are there any questions?
When we did this before, just because it becomes more realistic penalty, they were brought to us that the penalty was really steep, and that's why we decided to change it.
And then just as Mr. Witt said, it's this piece here in red, highlighted in red, that in your package was stricken. Again, that was previously approved but was never codified in the county's ordinance. And so really, so the update is the black bold piece to that section.
Correct. We'll open public hearing. Please keep your comments to 5 minutes on topic and directed to the board. Anybody have any comments? All right. Seeing none, we'll close the public hearing. Any other comments or anything, or anybody want to make a motion?
I move that the Board of Supervisors approve the amendments to the County Code to amend Section 20-1-2.1 to enact Section 20-1-7 for a public hearing.
We're
approving
to enact. This was the public hearing.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's just take. You can take out for a public hearing.
Okay. To enact it on this meeting, March 20th, 2024.
Second. All right, Mr. Sheridan made a motion, seconded by Mr. O'Brien. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Anybody opposed? Board votes aye. Passes 5-0. All right. So we're going to go back to
action matters.
Action matters. Item A. Advertisement of proposed fiscal year 2025 operations budget, tax rates, and capital improvement plan. Mrs. Milton?
Well, let me do one thing here because this wasn't updated.
Yes.
Really? It was me.
There's a slot machine back there you guys have to discover.
So I just wanted to bring these numbers back to you really quick since I only had 3 minutes to update them to show you that the advertised tax rates that are going to be going in the Flugana review for real estate and mobile homes will stay at 0.844 per 100. Personal property should actually say 410. That's for residential.
Oh, sorry. Making the changes here.
And personal property, business, and public utilities will stay at 290 and machinery and tools at 190.
All right. We already had comments. Want to make a motion?
I will. I move the Board of Supervisors authorize staff to advertise the fiscal year 25 budget, tax rates, and capital improvement plan for the public hearing on April 10, 2024. The proposed budget amount for fiscal year 25 is $109,232,910. The advertised tax rate are as follows: real property 84.4 per 100 of assessed value, mobile homes 84.4 per $100 of assessed value, personal property residential 410 per 100, personal property business and public utilities 290 per 100, machinery and tools 190 per 100.
One quick correction, I think you said 84.4, it should be 0.844.
I stand corrected. Real property 0.844 per 100 assessed value, and mobile homes 0.844 per 100 of assessed value.
We did a lot of calls.
Are we good?
All right.
Yes.
Well, we need a second. Second.
Okay.
Mr. Hodges made a motion. Mr. Sheridan has made a second.
Do you have to ask one question? Should there be an S on the end of right?
Yes.
Yes.
Bam! I got an English correction. Ms. Borth?
That's why I stumbled attention when it was up. It was not grammatically correct.
All right. Do you have a motion or a second? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Anybody opposed? Chair votes aye. Passes 5-0. We will move on to item B, authorization. Advertise for a public hearing to enact section 20-1-8 for the county code to exempt from taxation certain classes of tangible personal property. Mr. Whitman?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. Municode's will be very busy with all these amendments. So Virginia Code 58.1-3504 gives optional authority to localities to exempt from taxation certain classes of household goods and personal effects. So that's basically everything located within your house. Also, antique vehicles are included within this class. So the Commissioner of Revenue has actually already been exempting such classes of property for over 20 years. When I talked to him, it was just brought to his attention that the ordinance, according to our records, has never actually been adopted by the board. It's optional language. You actually have to have an ordinance adopting it. 58.1-3505 of the Virginia Code gives optional authority to localities to exempt from taxation certain classes of farm animals, grains and feeds, used for the nurture of farm animals, farm vehicles, machinery, implements, and equipment. So the Commissioner of Revenue has not been taxing cows or goats over the last 20 years. Some counties do.
And nor does he want to.
Nor does he want to. He's requesting this change. And so the ordinance was never previously been adopted. As optional authority, so this board does need to adopt the ordinance to continue the exception.
We can make him go out and count chickens.
Yep. Okay. Count heads of chickens.
And you can include certain classes. So if you only want to make them count cows, then I guess you could.
Yeah, right. So farm vehicles, farm machinery. I mean, you could have a combine machine that's worth a lot of money.
And I believe right now all that is exempt.
It's exempt right now.
It is exempt.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's been, according to Mr. Sheridan, it's been exempt for the last over 20 years. For all farm winery equipment, that's all exempt.
Okay.
Under. Currently, it's already
been. And even going back to the question I have with a classic car, if you have a car that has an antique plate on it, that's it's exempt.
And that's pretty common across our localities. My mom has her car from high school, a 1950 Jeepster, doesn't pay taxes on it. So it's pretty common across the state to exempt antique vehicles. But it is optional, so the board doesn't need to pass an ordinance. So the proposed amendment would enact section 20-1-8. Which would exempt all classes of property listed in these two code sections, 58.1-3504 and 58.1-3505. The public hearing would be held April 17th. But be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? I don't have any.
I move that the Board of Supervisors advertise amendments to the County Code to enact section 20-1-8 for a public hearing to be held April 17th, 2024.
Second.
Motion made by Mr. O'Brien, seconded by Mr. Sheridan. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Anybody opposed? Chair votes aye. Passes 5-0. All right, we're moving on to item C, James River Water Authority Resolution
support agreement and service agreement. Mr. Dahl?
Yep, I'll give Dan a break on one here for the evening.
With my sore throat.
That's right. So again, not going to go over all the stuff again. This is just showing you where the old route, which was approximately 1 mile, $9.7 million. The new route is four times the length. Project costs around $45.6 million. Again, this is just showing the overall project estimate of the items. Line 1 through 35 is the construction component of $39.687 million. And then another amount of cost for permitting, property acquisition, construction support services, about 5.9. That's where the $45.6 million project cost comes in. So currently the GRWA has funding to get it through May/June of 2024. The GRWA submitted a spring pool application to the Virginia Resource Authority. Some VRA loan conditions that must be satisfied prior to final pricing on April 15th in order to be included in the spring funding is one, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers permit. That process is going. We got comments back on Monday. The comments are minor. We are ever so hopeful that we will see that permit in time. In addition, a condition from VRA is all other required permits are also that are related to the project are also needed. So the county's local ENS permit, any type of stormwater permits from DEQ, things like that would be needed as well prior to that April 15th deadline. In addition to that, providing evidence of the purchase of any wetland mitigation credits, stream credits, nutrient mitigation credits, and all other environmental mitigation credits would also be necessary prior to that date. And we did push back on VRA a little bit on this. They were a little stringent on us on this, a little maybe more so than usual. But I think just with the history of the project, they want to make sure that everything is in place prior to pricing. Again, in the board package, you saw the general conditions that were submitted from the Virginia Resource Authority. So looking at estimated annual debt service for the project. So again, based on if the total ends up being around $49 million at a 4.5% interest rate on 30 years, that total annual debt service would be $3 million a year. That is for JRWA. 50% of that is Luvana's portion. 50% of that would be Louise's portion. Included in that is around $2.2 million of capitalized interest in fiscal year 25, roughly around a $3 million local debt service reserve fund. And with those, the first debt service payment would not take effect until fiscal year 26. So one thing, if you do not get the required loan conditions by April 15th, the JRWA will need to put out an RFP for interim financing through the calendar year. This is certainly not preferred, but we're trying to get everything done in time to get to the funding through VRA. And then again, if we had to go the interim financing route, we would just put our application would be there to ready to go for the summer pool. So again, Luvana County resolutions approving the financing are before you today. The Virginia Resource Authority requires all local approvals by March 22nd. Louisa County had this on Monday. Their board voted unanimously on this. Final pricing takes place on April 15th, and the tentative closing to take place on May 15th. So just a little thing about the documents in the package. You know, the resolution purpose will be conditioning the member jurisdictions undertaking the non-binding obligations to appropriate from time to time monies to the Water Authority in connection with payments due under the amendment to the service agreement. Also, as part of this resolution, so it's being issued at a not to exceed debt total amount of $49 million. And a not to exceed interest rate at 5.75, but the anticipated interest rate will be closer to 4.5%. And the reason you put the slightly higher rate, and let's just say you put in 4.4% and it came in at 4.5%, you could not move forward with the financing because it exceeded that interest rate. Some other documents, the amended and restated support agreement. Again, it's a non-binding obligation to appropriate such county debt service payments as may be requested from time to time, pursuant to the agreement to the fullest degree and in such manner that is consistent with the Constitution and laws of the Commonwealth. And basically, it recognizes that the board is not empowered to make binding commitments to such appropriations in future fiscal years, but it's basically stating its intent to do so and recommends future boards to do likewise. And then the third document, amendment to the service agreement, just outlines the JRWA and the counties agreed to certain terms, conditions, covenants, and matters pertaining to the development and construction of the system. And I'd be happy to answer questions that the board has.
Questions?
I think this is a must-do.
My only question would be, would we be better off to pay it in cash from general fund?
In term?
Y'all know the money stuff better than I do that.
The only thing is, well...
Yeah, it's a fair question. I'm sure there's fees associated with taking out finances.
Oh, yeah, there are. There's always
fees. And we're paying finances.
There's always fees with taking out issued debt service.
You're talking about a month. Why go through the process of financing?
Keep your speed.
Well, so the problem is, I mean, from the financing piece, again, the actions before you is for the final financing. That's what this is. If for some reason that those items, those permit items, are not available until April 15th, these agreements are basically, they basically go away because we're not going into this pool because we didn't meet those conditions of the loan.
Right.
So if that comes forward, the JRWA would go out for interim financing. I think yes, to answer your question, there is an opportunity for both boards potentially to put in funding for interim financing if they want. If we do not, if for some reason we don't meet the conditions by April 15th for the permanent financing. So I think that's something I could bring back to the board.
Well, I'm guessing you could see, you know, fees 10, 15, 20,000 or more.
Probably more than that, but yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, okay, why are we paying that?
Yeah, I mean, so the board could, I mean, so for that, to do, instead of doing interim financing, the board or boards flew in and
We'd have to do it together then, wouldn't we?
Yeah.
Yes, they would have to want to be able to do funding it cash funded too. Now the thing we could do potentially, which we did speak about, is there are things called reimbursement resolutions. So let's just say that June 1st, let's just say we're all out of funds and we started, both boards appropriated funds for the interim piece. There's something called a reimbursement resolution where both counties could get reimbursed for those funds that they put up, which would be part of the summer pool that we entered into. So that is always an option. Again, we're trying to go forward and go for final, but if for some reason, which we're hoping we do, we hit all the necessary things by April 15th, I would come back to the board and you know, see if you wanted to do something different.
Sure. I asked this question last week.
Yep.
I hate to do financing when we know, well, we don't know for sure, but hopefully we're being reimbursed. And that eats up a big chunk of the reimbursement if we're paying $10 million for financing over 30 years or whatever.
I mean, there's nothing, usually after a couple of years, there's not too many repayment penalties.
Okay.
And we'll have other things that we'll maybe take that reimbursement from.
Yeah, like I said, that's my only hesitation.
Yeah.
Anyways, I guess the question on that would be, you know, are we reimbursed based on the payment cost, or are we reimbursed based on the total amount?
You're reimbursed on cost, but there's
a hiccup on that, right?
Yes, one, they don't have approvals, meaning Dominion, and secondly, there's something I want to talk to Dan about, which is about pursuing funding, their funding stream from a different angle.
Right.
From a potential debt service angle. And so there's been some back and forth on that, but
cost, the actual cost for the year. So if you're doing financing, you know, on that $3 million a year, you know, that you're paying, then presumably it's being paid back at $1.5 million as opposed to an upfront charge.
I think I'm missing something here.
So I think what Mr. Sheridan was saying was that if we would ultimately get reimbursed by Dominion for the JRWA,
yep,
right, would they take the approach if we have it financed, right, that they're going to reimburse the, you know, let's say the total cost is $49 million,
yep,
our share is $24.5 million. Yep. Would they give us $24.5 million, or would they give us the $1.5 million that we're paying year one, $1.5 million that we're paying year two?
So what the proffer language says is we'll reimburse on actual, and I don't have it right for me, I think actual,
like, invoices.
As we pay out. I think as we pay out.
Construction costs. Now, I think there's an angle that maybe could be made that, okay, so say you take out debt service. Now, I don't think, let's see, if you took out the debt service, I don't think the interest could be considered actual cost, but could the principal amount that you took out to pay for the project, could that be considered actual cost of the project?
Yeah.
So there's some...
I mean, presumably we would want to be paid up front as opposed to being paid on an annual basis.
It's a reimbursement basis. You're not being paid up front.
You're being paid when the cost is being put
in. Yes.
So I'm just saying...
And right now,
you know, over 20 years and
30,
you know, 30 years, right? As opposed to it being completed in 3 years, there's still a big difference, right?
Well, yeah, and the issue is right now, I've made multiple attempts to my representative with Dominion, and I've been getting crickets.
Well, we can have a closed session use permit.
It might be a closed session topic.
The board reserves the right to remove the special use permit. I think that might get attention.
Yeah, sorry. I'm sorry, guys. What I'm talking about is I don't want to use up everything that they're giving us paying for financing.
Yeah, I don't
understand
when
that.
When they're supposed to be paying us back as we pay.
Yeah, and again, the only thing with the Dominion money, remember, the Dominion money is for is for a lot of water projects.
Yeah. And correct, but I don't want to use it all up on one.
Especially before we get it back down my way.
Well, no, I mean, but I guess that's the thing. I mean, you can only use so much of the project for this one, and the large majority of it is for the Fork Union Water Supply project.
Okay.
That's what the largest.
Is there a set amount that can't be exceeded for the first portion of it?
So the way it works is the way the proffer was written, there was an amount specified to the JRWA, and it was roughly $7.6 million. There was a pocket called unanticipated costs that was roughly around $11 million and some change. I think the $11 million and some change gives the county wiggle room to use it for what project they feel they need to go for. And then the remainder between that 17 and the 47 million for water stuff, basically there's 30 million that's earmarked specific to the Fork Union Water Supply project. So that's kind of how it's all broken out.
Alrighty.
I move that the Board of Supervisors approve the resolution entitled Resolution Approving the Execution and Delivery of an Amended and Restated Support Agreement for James River Water Authority for the James River Water Authority, and further authorize the County Administrator to execute the support agreement entitled Amended and Restated Support Agreement for James River Water Authority and the service agreement entitled Amendment to Service Agreement, subject to the County Attorney's approval as to form.
Second.
Motion made by Mr. O'Brien, seconded by Mr. Hodge. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Anybody opposed? Board votes aye. Zero. Passes 5-0. All right. Moving on to item D, amendments to the county code for small-scale, minor-scale and utility-scale solar generation facilities. Mr. Whitman.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. So at the board meeting on March 6th, the board approved a resolution of intention to amend section 22-4-2.2 to remove utility-scale solar generation facilities as a use allowed by special use permit in the A1 zoning district. So in accordance with the zoning code, the board can adopt this resolution, and then the resolution is referred to the Planning Commission. And the Planning Commission would then need to hold a public hearing before providing a recommendation to the board. So at the, there's a copy of the ordinance, what it would look like basically. This is striking through utility scale solar generation facilities as a use allowed. So the Planning Commission did consider this at March 12th, and they said that basically they wanted some time to talk to staff, talk to the community, and staff had discussed should we have a timeline basically for the Planning Commission to hold the public hearing and send the recommendation to the board. So a timeline of 90 days was suggested just for this amendment to remove the use. For the supplemental regulations, we discussed 180 days.
I thought we discussed 60 days and then 90 to the, they put it at 90 to the board.
Well, basically, Mr. Dahl and I were discussing 60 days might be a little tight with the Planning Commission having a work session, then having a public hearing. It'd be tight, that 60-day window. So that's what
actually
we
giving
give.
It to the board.
So we wanted to give a little leeway.
Okay, but we didn't discuss 90 days. But I'm okay with it, but I'm just saying.
Sorry. I was saying staff. Yeah, I should have said Mr. Dahl and I discussed. After discussing it with you, we discussed pushing it to 90 days because basically we're worried about the timeline getting it to the board because the Planning Commission is going to hold another work session first. We're not planning to advertise a public hearing at April meeting. It would go to the Planning Commission May meeting for a public hearing, and then they would make a recommendation, or they could defer it. So this gives them the chance also if they want to defer it 1 month to then make a recommendation. So it just gives a little more wiggle room. But if the board wants it to be 60 days, I mean, we can do 60 days. You can amend the motion.
It's definitely there. Recommendation that they have as ample time possible to have these discussions. So,
I'm good with 90. I just think somebody should have mentioned it to me if that's where we were. And
I apologize. I'll take the hit on that one.
So, at the board meeting on March 6th, the board also adopted a resolution to enact 22-17-21 to add supplemental regulations for small scale, minor scale, and utility scale solar generation. Same thing, the Planning Commission would need to hold a public hearing before providing the recommendation. So for this one, we had discussed 180 days, basically would be the timeline to hold a public hearing and send a recommendation to the board. And for this one, the Planning Commission said they definitely need more time to consult with the community, maybe have a community meeting, a Q&A type meeting, and also look at other localities. I had showed them the Albemarle, the Louise, and the Lancaster ordinances that they said they want more time to just look at. So that's why we suggest 180 days for that one to come back with a recommendation. So the other question, is there any questions on that?
I'll make a comment at the end.
So the other question that came up from the Planning Commission was basically, what do we do with the existing applications? We had CEP Solar that came to the Planning Commission in November, and it was deferred. Now it's deferred to June for the Planning Commission to make a decision. So basically, under the state code, the board has to make a decision within 12 months of that first initial public hearing, unless CEP Solar, agrees to defer it out further. Now, White Oak Solar did say they're willing to work with the county on the supplemental regulations. I mean, obviously, if it was removed as a use in A1, the project can't come to fruition. So I said they were only willing to work with the county if we were going to just amend the supplemental regulations, basically. So the board does have to make a decision within 12 months to act upon the application under the state code. So when staff discussed it, we discussed 6 months, basically. The board wouldn't consider any applications before this board, but to give a little more, next slide, please. A little more time, we thought about why don't we say until the second meeting of October, because a decision has to be made by this board by the November meeting to fit within that 12-month timeline. So that's actually 7 months would give time basically when the board would give a decision. Now, obviously, if the use is no longer allowed in the A1 and we're not, and the board doesn't grandfather existing applications, that kind of all depends on how that ordinance is approved by the board. So basically, the delay would give Planning Commission board time to consider all the amendments to the county code. Are there any questions about the motions or the resolution?
So did this include that's what I'm looking for?
You're looking for the word moratorium.
Moratorium.
So I did a little more research on moratorium because that's what I believe is Halifax County had done a moratorium. And I tried to find it on their website, couldn't find the resolution, but I did a little more research and I don't believe what they did had legal authority. I don't think they can do a blanket just moratorium. What you can do is take advantage of the fact that you have 12 months to consider an application. So you can delay the decision while you're amending your code, but you can't just do a blanket moratorium. So after researching it further, I think what Halifax did, I don't think that meets the Virginia code. So under Dillon rule, I don't think they had the authority to issue that blanket moratorium at their meeting.
And really the reason going back to the 7 months is that goes back to White Oak, basically. That'll be up to their technically 12 months since they submitted. Or was it submitted right. Or since?
Well, it's when the public hearing. So I talked to Harry Kingery with White Oak Solar, and we both agreed it would be the public hearing is when the 12 months starts. So we had talked about this in January when they were first deferring, or maybe it was December when they were first deferring, and we both agreed that the 12 month period started at the public hearing.
So would motion one just apply to CEP, or would that apply to any? I mean, I guess.
So let's say Pine Gate applied. Right now it's not even on the agenda.
Yeah.
But let's say they apply, they want to come in May. Then basically, the public hearing was in May, the board would have 12 months to, you know, basically approve or deny that application.
But would that, let's say it came up next month, or it was through the Planning Commission next month, and then, you know, to us, would that also fall into the October time frame as well?
No.
Okay. No. It would go longer. I mean, again, they could still apply to the Planning Commission, but it would be the 12 months from the Planning Commission public hearing for the board to make their decision.
So what this delays any board decisions, basically, until October of this year.
Yeah.
So to be clear, these are three separate resolutions here.
There's three separate motions, so... Yeah. Basically, you can approve any or all of the resolutions, but there are three separate items. You know, the first one deals with basically existing applications and future applications, and then the second and third deal with the ordinance amendments that the Planning Commission is considering, and basically putting a timeline on the Planning Commission to give a recommendation.
How does the first motion address that?
The first motion basically, if you go to that resolution,
yeah.
So basically what that resolution says is to give time for the Planning Commission to consider the ordinance amendments. Basically, the board will not hear any applications until the second meeting in October. Will not hold any public hearings.
And again, this goes back to the question of can the county do a moratorium? You can't do a moratorium, but you can delay it to a certain point to go through and get the proper regulations in place.
Correct.
Not just the proper.
You can get regulations in place.
The chosen
regulations. Chosen regulations.
Chosen regulations.
And it was the Planning Commission that wanted to do the moratorium, right?
The Planning Commission discussed it and basically what can we do? And so that was the topic of moratorium came up because Halifax County had done it the week prior.
Okay.
And it was in the newspapers.
I think it's really important that we get these regulations in place. I went out to that Palmer Solar place for the second brush fire, and there was growth from the previous year that was dead that fed the fire, and the damage from the first fire hadn't even been repaired. The screening was down. There were some serious issues. If we had to go between the panels at midday when they were down, we wouldn't have got a brush truck between them. So spacing, screening, the amount of time that we give them to repair, the requirements to keep the vegetation down, because the fuel load in there was huge, and had it taken off more than what it was, we could have had a huge fire. And there was the damage panel from the previous time that they hadn't even fixed. And there was wires down from other panels. So you'd think when the solar generation went down that they would have come out and attempted to fix it. That's money just being thrown away, but they just didn't seem that bothered, which kind of falls in line with what some people were saying. You know, that they're just putting it in to make money and they really don't care after that. And it worried me slightly to think that what's it going to look like when it's no longer generating them money? So we do need, how are they going to dispose of it? What are the bonds going to be? What's the spacing going to be like? What's the maintenance of the facility, the screening, the vegetation? We need to get those rules in place.
Yeah, I don't question that at all as far as regulations in terms of, you know, what we should look for. I wonder if, what is the benefit, because let's be frank, if we put this in I-1 only, and now I-1 with a special use permit, which we, by definition, are then saying it's only going to be in industrial zoned areas, which is exactly what we really don't want this, because that's our commercial areas that we're applying stuff. Then we're essentially saying we're just not going to allow solar in this county. And, you know, I think the discussion matter is, you know, down to, you know, what, how the, you know, the board votes, of course, but also how the community perceives this. You know, I think that these, probably both of these things should happen within the same time frame, not within separate time frames. Because, again, I said it last time, I don't see the purpose of regulations when you've already pretty much done an outright ban. And I don't know that dividing this up into two different hearings really gives the public the full knowledge and scope of what is being asked. Certainly there are people that are going to be in favor of it. Certainly there are people who are not going to be in favor of it. I think these should be considered at the same time. Yeah, so I would recommend that they both be 180 days. It's my recommendation.
I respectfully disagree that they're not bolted together. I don't see any tie that keeps them together, and there's nothing about this particular, about the A1 portion that would take 6 months for them to review. So I wouldn't see any reason to hold off on that. And if there's protections that do come from that, then I wouldn't want those protections holding just because they're randomly tied to the to our policies.
My point wasn't so much the Planning Commission's ability to review it as much as the public's ability to review and see the two hand in hand. That was really my point there. Because I think that there is confusion among the public thinking that, you know, we're doing something about solar. Some may or may not recognize that motion number one is pretty much an outright ban of solar, and can be confused with motion number two, it's an outright ban of solar, and motion number three is essentially saying we're going to put regulations. You may have a lot of the public in place that is in favor of the regulations, myself included, but not in favor of the putting of eliminating the use in agricultural with a special use permit. So that's my concern, is that I think we're muddling the issues with the public, not the Planning Commission's ability to review.
And that when I started to say something, I was going to say what Tim had said, that, you know, there's certain things that are dangers that we just don't know about. And one of them was, when those panels are out, do we have enough room to get our equipment through there to fight a fire? Because literally we had, I was behind the wheel with a little girl that literally lived backed up to the fence every day.
Yep.
When I left her driveway. We need to be able to get there to fight it. But then when you get there, you got to be careful that you don't get electrocuted because you can't cut them off.
No, the chief raised great points on that. I thought that was, you know, excellent. It again lends itself to why the Planning Commission should review the ordinances that we put in place and make recommendations. I don't disagree with that at all. I don't think that
if somebody puts in, you know, whatever the cost is, and Mr. Putnam had said $500,000 per acre, I don't know if that's accurate or not, but I can't imagine that anybody who's making that investment wants it to go up in flames either. So, I would think that you know, they're still looking for the ability to make sure they get the revenue. And by the way, you know, more than likely is the fact that the solar panels are replaced with newer and more efficient solar panels.
You would hope so.
Yeah.
I mean, by the same token, there's a saying of friction fire. So as it ages, the insurance policy starts rubbing up against the cost. Poof. Yeah. And they write it off as an insurance thing and replace it.
Possible.
My
inclination would actually be to probably keep the 90 and extend the 180 closer to, I guess, I don't know how much closer you could get with that 180 days.
Why don't we let
extend, I mean, it doesn't, within
a month after that, we have to make a decision.
Is it a month? Okay. Because my thought process was, it doesn't take, I don't think it, because of the way the meetings fall and things like that, I mean, they can have a conversation and discuss, and they already were having a great conversation about these two separate items. Let them make a decision on the I guess it's the second one on here, but really the first motion that we're talking about with days. I don't think you need 90 days to determine whether or not it's a ZTA, and if ultimately, you know, they send us something and it's their recommendation is to not remove the special use permit request, and they can subsequently, or even if before then, I mean, this says minimum 90 days, so they could make a decision sooner. And then if their request is not, they can start working on, okay, now what do those ordinances look like? Because we have sent them two separate things.
But if their request is not, then we should be taking the vote. And if our decision is, yes, we're going to put it in industrial, then it really begs the question, why are we asking them to look at regulations?
Well, then I think it makes... I think it makes sense to make that 60 and make them come up with
it is as confusing to the public, and that's the point, is that there are, I guarantee you, if you have conversations, there are plenty of people that won't know that these are two different issues, but they will say, oh yeah, we need to regulate it.
I mean, the reason you have to put the regulations in place is, one, because the Planning Commission could say, I think you should allow it in A1. We could restrict it in A1, and the state could, in the next session, take the legislation up that they've tabled and say, well, you guys can't do that, and it's allowed in A1, and we're caught without the regulations in place. And at some point in the future, we could say, well, actually, we think our regulations are robust enough that we should allow it in A1. So, I mean, this kind of puts it to the Planning Commission, gives us room to breathe, puts the regulations in place, and then we can see what happens from there. I mean, there's a lot of paths this could take going forward.
I think your point is a good point. I still think the confusion point is still relevant. You know, that you're by separating these two things out there, you may be getting two different things. So.
Yeah. So the reason why we come, 60 days would be tough, is when we looked at the calendar, that means the public hearing would have to be in April because of where the Planning Commission falls. Because the May meeting is the 7th. So that was why we said 60 days.
90 days.
That's what we said, 90 days. It was just only tough.
I think 90 days at the minimum.
Yeah. I mean, the Planning Commission, anytime we remand something down to them, they can always come back and say, hey, we tried to do this in this time. Can you give us 30 more days?
Yeah, I couldn't see anything in that would, I don't know what they'd work on that would take them 90 days to analyze that A1 piece of it.
If they get to working with the public and decide that they need more time to understand more people, because they're going to be the ones that are dealing with it, not us.
Well, I agree with that in the other piece, creating the ordinances.
I mean, they can always come back and ask, we can say no. But I mean, if they ask, I think we should do everything we can to oblige them.
Yes.
And allow them ample time.
I'm happy with them the way they are. I do think we need to proceed.
And I'll make the first, is it three separate names?
Three separate motions.
Yes. I move that the Board of Supervisors approve the resolution regarding consideration of applications by the Board of Supervisors for minor scale and utility scale solar generation facilities.
Second.
Motion made by Mr. Goad, seconded by Mr. Hodge. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
I'm against, because I think we're changing the rules on people next year.
Chair votes aye, passes 4-1.
I move that the Board of Supervisors request the Planning Commission make a recommendation to the Board of Supervisors within 90 days on the ordinance to amend Section 22-4-2.2 of the County Code to remove utility-scale solar generation facilities as a use allowed by special use permit in the agricultural A1 zoning district.
Second.
Motion made by Mr. Goad, seconded by Mr. Hodge. All in favor, say aye.
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 All opposed?
Aye.
Chair votes aye. Passes 4-1.
I move that the Board of Supervisors request that the Planning Commission make a recommendation to the Board of Supervisors within 180 days on the ordinance to enact Section 22-17-21 to add supplemental regulations for small-scale solar generation facilities, minor-scale solar generation facilities, and utility-scale solar generation facilities.
Second.
Motion made by Mr. Goad, seconded by Mr. Hodge. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Chair votes aye, passes 5-0. Consent agenda. Next to the consent agenda. Anybody have anything you want to pull?
Make a motion we adopt the consent agenda as.
Second.
Motion made by Mr. Sheridan to adopt, seconded by Mr. Hodge. All in favor say aye.
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 Anyone opposed? Board chair votes aye, passes 5-0. All right. Any unfinished business? New business. I just want to update because of the earlier conversation about the schools. One of the things we talked, Eric and I met with the schools this morning, and a good idea that came up was for CIP items that we start in January meeting at a different CIP location. So, for example, the two tracks. January would meet at one, February would meet at the next, and then maybe the bathrooms on.
I got plenty of pictures of the one at the middle school if you want me to show them to you. Like but I said, I've been saying, and we should.
And I've seen it.
This is just one of those things. I've said it for 5 years. I'm just glad that we're finally addressing it. Because, guys, I'm telling you right now, it's a miracle. We haven't had a child get hurt.
That's rough.
Yeah, and even if you don't do that, then, you know, certainly like a video presentation or whatever.
Well, like I said, we had a discussion because it was myself, Mr. Fairchild, Dr. Gratz, and then Mr. Key and Mr. Reed. They took part today, and so we were talking about for like the next budget year, really starting in January when we do the kind of the kind of the joint meetings, just meeting at a different school location, and then you know if there's something we want to see, we can go into kind of take looks of the different locations to kind of see the conditions.
I was pleased Mr. Kelly reached out to me and then made all of the arrangements to get me in the facilities to see firsthand. I've never.
Anytime you want to come to the middle school, I know somebody's got a key.
It's good to see it firsthand.
This all came up because a school board member asked me if I knew if any other board members other than yourself had seen these tracks, and I didn't.
7 years ago.
The issues with the high school track started 2 years after it started popping already because of the drainage is not good.
Yeah. Well, there's
issue with the drainage, and that started popping a little bit like the third year we were there, and now it's got spots coming up, but I'm telling you guys, Coach Carter, God bless him. The only reason we've survived is he goes out there on his own and tries to patch that track all the time, and he
middle rear end off on
it. Yes, the middle school track. I mean, it's like I said, we looked down the other day, and the guy, my buddy that I teach with, goes, "Man, the shingles are blowing off the roof." I said, "Dude, that ain't a shingle. It's a piece of track about the size of the shingle. The wind had blown off."
And then just another quick item for us to, and I think, I know Eric and I've talked, and maybe Dan too, about the, Dan also about the building on 53, the large farm building that's being built.
I asked about that, whether that went through a TRC.
I know that
place. That looked industrial.
That the one by
Plainly? Yeah, I think it has an exemption, is what I've heard.
Yes. So, I'm as you can imagine, being in my district, since we've talked about it, I'm getting a lot of people asking me about it. And my concern is that we don't have clarity that I can see after we talked of how many bales of hay do you have to put in to a building for it to be ag. And so you have Dusty Christian, who went through everything he did to put his building in down Lake Monticello Road, that it looks to me is smaller than this one out in the field. And I'm not giving these people a hard time. They did what they had the right to do. But again, they're gonna have, Dusty's gonna have his equipment in there. These people are in the earth moving business. They're gonna have some of their equipment in their farm building. How do we make Dusty go through all this? And I just don't see the, I'm not sure where the lines are to.
Yeah, I think the building official makes the determination after hearing the evidence, whether it's ag use or whether the ag exemption applies. But I mean, if they ever use it like
for business
a purpose. Business purpose off site, then no ag, the ag exemption doesn't apply. And they'd have to get a permit and they'd have to get a change of use. So let's say they have a contracting business and they go off site, they'd have to get a change of use for that.
What if the board said no to them?
Well, then they can't do that.
Yeah, I mean, you have to look at, in that zone for a contractor storage yard.
That requires a special use permit, right?
In A1?
Oh, I'm certain.
So basically, the change of use will require a special use permit for that contractor storage yard. So then it'd have to come through the planning commission. So if there's evidence they were using it not to store round bales and tractors, but to store, you know, Mack trucks and excavators, then yeah, they'd have to come back and contract the storage.
And again, with this too, I would gather that you probably have businesses around the county that are operating different things, whether it's from a repair shop to other things that are probably not in the correct zoning or didn't go through the correct process for what they're doing right now.
So there are a lot of guys with small earth moving businesses and plumbing businesses and so on that are completely licensed and have a barn that they do farm stuff with, and they pull their piece of equipment in there too. So are we saying that every one of those is in violation? It depends on the level of the use. You know, for the, I mean, it's kind of a reasonable person determination by the building official whether that really falls under ag use or not. Because basically, if they don't agree to get the SUP, we'd be taking them to court. So we'd have to prove to a judge they need an SUP. This is not an ag exemption. So it's kind of an analysis whether it falls under contractor storage yard or it falls under ag exemption.
And I think, wasn't Mr. Williams also doing some sort of storefront as well, too? Is that the same?
Mr. The one on Dusty. Lake Monticello Road.
Oh, Dusty.
Yeah.
I don't believe so, no.
Sort of.
No,
that's just equipment storage.
He just started moving
equipment,
dirt.
I think the building to store the equipment and then to maybe work on the equipment, maybe?
Or no? He stores the equipment behind Ace Hardware now.
There's an administration building or something like that.
No, I don't think so.
Which one do you think
it's Christian and Associates?
This is the one on Lake Monticello Road.
This is the one where all the dirt's been moved over
this
there.
This is the one across from the storage facility.
Yeah, new storage building.
It seems loose to me, and maybe there's no better way, but if it's up to the discretion of one person, and it looks to me like we go back to how one person is treated compared to another.
Well, I shouldn't say one person, also the zoning administrator. Because the zoning administrator from the zoning angle could say no, that requires an SUP. So you have the building side and the zoning side that are both looking at it.
But solely up to their discretion?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, they have authority under the zoning and building code to make that determination.
Well, what I had imagined was some sort of clear in writing, I don't know if ordinance is the word or what, but something clearly showing what qualifies and what doesn't. To me, like in this case, let's say he
does start storing his equipment that he uses in his business, and that's the business he's in. The building's up. There's no process or what are we going
to
do then?
Because we can take him to court and fine him for illegally using the building, or we can file an injunction and say you're not allowed to use the building because that use is not allowed. So we have tools. We have enforcement tools, to stop that use.
He's taking his equipment off site on a daily basis, and suddenly that becomes a question mark.
Yeah, it's going to be a tough situation because a building that big.
I'm looking in the A1 code section. I don't see contractor storage yard as a special use permit, so it might also require a text amendment to allow that to A1 as a use. Allow that special use.
Is it just an industrial then?
This is I-1.
B1, I think. Maybe B1 as well. Oh, I-1 and I-2, yeah.
So is it allowed by right then? Because it's not specifically excluded?
No. The way our ordinance reads, if it's not listed, it's not allowed.
It's not allowed.
Yeah.
So you feel comfortable there's not gray area there?
I mean, I can drive out and look at it. I haven't looked at it in a few weeks since they're first building it.
Yeah, it's massive.
I've received a complaint. My brother-in-law complained to me about it, so. Yeah.
It's a good size building.
But I know I've talked to Andy about it because he's had her concerns.
I told Mr. Goat I thought it was an Amazon data center and we were going to get some money.
But I mean, I can talk to the zoning administrator and building official and say, let's the three of us go out there and look at it.
And again, I'm not trying to, that building's coming up. You know, I'm not trying to go after them. I'm just trying to help prevent potentially the same in the future. I mean, could we not have an ordinance that says, that speaks to square footage?
Ag exemption, there's no maximum square footage.
Pink barn if you want to, as big as you like.
Sounds like
yeah.
It.
I mean, you think a turkey barn, how big that is.
Yeah.
Contractor storage yards are allowed by right in the I-2, by special use permit in the B-1. So they're allowed in other zoning districts, so they require a text amendment as well. But I can talk to the building official tomorrow about it.
Speaking of new business and zoning text amendments, since we just put in place the short-term rental one and we talked about having an SUP, could you look at that and make sure we have the SUP exemption?
Yeah.
This is not new business. I should have said it earlier. Last week I brought up the thing about our kids going down to compete in the Nationals last weekend. And I don't know about all of them. Two of them, one of them, made sure I knew about it. One of them was riding with me. Our boys 4x800-meter relay team finished third out of 21 teams at the Nationals. Now, this isn't the whole nation represented, but these are teams coming from all over the East Coast. And then young lady's going to be running for Longwood next year, Ms. Sophie Farley, finished fourth, I believe, in the 1,000. So, I don't know if we can do something just to recognize them or something. If a kid does something nationally to be recognized, it's probably not a bad thing.
Yeah.
What would we do?
I don't know.
I mean, that's a resolution.
We have a resolution recognizing.
Yeah.
Maybe recognize.
We do it for the Eagle Scouts.
Something of that nature.
Huh? We do it for Eagle Scouts.
Yeah.
I mean, national level.
Yeah.
That's pretty sick.
That's pretty impressive. All right.
I'm down.
I'm done.
I just had one item.
Comment.
I wanted to thank Mr. Dahl and the finance team for the hard work that they've done getting the budget to where we're at today.
Amen.
I appreciate it.
Yeah. Them, the schools, everyone.
Yeah.
I mean, everybody's really tried to work for the most part to get to where we are. And believe it or not, in spite of the little bit of bad news we got today, it's good news.
It is.
Because it's tax relief for our citizens.
I'm going to open up our second round of public comment. Anybody wishing to address the board to come to the podium, state your name and address. Please remember to keep your comments to 5 minutes on topic and direct it to the board. Anybody wish to come to the podium? Susie, you looked like you were getting up. I wasn't sure.
Well,
you're good.
I don't know that I should say anymore.
I hear you.
Yes, babe.
In that case,
but
seeing none. Seeing none, we'll close the second round of public comments.
Mr. Chair, I move the Planet County Board of Supervisors and move to a closed meeting pursuant to the provisions of Section 2.2.3
know, Richard, let's see, 2.2-3711A1, 2.2-3711A5, 2.2-3711A7, and yeah, we still have to do 2.2-3711A8 of the Code of Virginia 1950 as amended. For the purposes of discussing employees of the Public Works Department under personnel, prospective industry, prospective business updates in the Columbia, Cunningham, and Fort Kenyon District, litigation, Gate Plaza, and the Chamber of Commerce agreement under legal matters.
Second. Motion made by Mr. O'Brien, seconded by Mr. Sheridan. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Anybody against? Four votes aye. Pass 5-0.
Chair, I move to close the meeting and be adjourned. And the Fluvanna County Board of Supervisors convene again in open session. Be resolved, the Board of Supervisors does hereby certify to the best of each member's knowledge one only public business matters lawfully exempted from open meeting requirements under Section 2.2-3711A of the Code of Virginia 1950 as amended, and two only such public business matters as were identified in the motion by which the closed meeting was convened were heard, discussed, or considered in the meeting.
Second. Motion made by Mr. O'Brien, seconded by Mr. Sheridan. All in favor?
Yep.
Roll call.
Mr. Allen says aye.
Mr. Goode says aye.
Mr. Sheridan says aye.
The dude says aye.
The chair says aye.
The regular.
Passes 5-0.
Motion to adjourn.
Caitlin.
Second. Caitlin's like, can you please say it?
Motion made by Mr. Sheridan, seconded by Mr. Hodge. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Chair votes no. Passes 4-1.